Welcome to the Game of Thrones podcast, the officially unofficial podcast for Game of Thrones on HBO. I'm Jim.
I'm Aaron.
And today we're talking about Season 8, Episode 4, titled The Last of the Starks. I can't believe there are only two more episodes of this great show left.
I can't believe there's only four more Starks.
Yeah, that's only twice as many as the episode number.
Right.
I mean, it just struck me that, like, in 2 weeks, Game of Thrones is over.
Yeah.
And I'm sort of sad about that because I 90% like this episode.
Okay.
I think there's basically one scene that doesn't work for me, but everything else I thought was in some weird way like a return to old Game of Thrones that we saw a couple of seasons ago. You have a lot of characters playing some games here, which is what I love about Game of Thrones.
Yes. I think that they are definitely hearkening back to that. And after the Night King's dalliance, they wanted to get back to the human drama. And I actually, when I, you know, keep in mind, declared fan bankruptcy and I've got a fresh slate of, I got a clean the slate. I thought, and then putting aside that this wasn't the story I wanted them to tell, I'm like, I think they're doing a pretty good job of telling the story that they want to tell. But the glaring exception is these guys just really don't know how to stage.
Yeah. It's the Euron ambush is the biggest problem in this episode.
It's the meeting in front of the walls of King's Landing. Like, there's almost walking dead levels of obtuseness about this is the set piece we set. Logically giving everyone's motivations, this is what would happen, but it won't because either we're blind to the scene that we have painted and the logical ramifications of it, or, you know, hell, we just whatever, and, you know.
You see the problems, you don't care.
Yeah.
There's
only two more episodes left. Fuck it.
Like, right. At times, it does feel like someone, you know, a production crew, or let's say the showrunner is sort of just trying to get to the end of this thing.
Being
over it. But at times, it feels like there are some truly great moments of writing
sure.
in here.
Yeah.
I thought a lot of stuff that happens is, and I really like the way that the celebration at the beginning is filmed, the feast.
Uh-huh.
It kind of puts you into that location in a way that I don't think I've seen in Game of Thrones before. Uh-huh. It has like a looser feel to it.
Yeah, I mean, name one 50-minute section of a show where people are just hanging loose and having fun.
Yeah.
I don't think it's ever happened.
It sometimes approaches that during some other celebrations in the show, but there's always this tinge, and I felt it here in this episode, this tinge of, oh no, something is going to go wrong. There's so much tension in those scenes. In this scene, other than like thinking, oh, maybe the Gold Company is going to show up knocking at the door any second now.
Right.
They're weak and vulnerable.
Which this could happen. The show would pull
that. Right. Yeah. I mean, I've definitely got a sort of Red Wedding. This is all going to turn in a second.
Yeah.
But the fact that it doesn't happen on second watch, I'm thinking like, man, they're just sitting back and enjoying their victory.
How many
I think that's
notes
important.
Does a bard get into the Reigns of Cast? Even if he just played as a joke, like even if it's just like a drunk northerner to put him up to it, like no mate, it'll slip. How many notes does he get into before he's just full of crossbow bolts?
Exactly two.
He gets like
the first note.
And then
the first note, he gets the benefit of the doubt.
Yeah.
The second note, he's full.
Yeah. Well, yeah. That's a suspicious note, but let not second note fuck
yeah.
you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I can kill that bard in two notes.
Yeah.
That's the Westerosi version of that game show.
It's too bad because, like, you know, the one of the B-side, Baron of Maiden Fair, has a song that has the first three notes of the Reigns of Castamere. But
you
got
to steer clear.
I can't
this
blame
is not the time.
I can't blame him for being jumpy in Winterfell.
For sure.
But yeah.
So yeah, there's a lot of good stuff with Sansa and Daenerys. I don't know what you mean when you say this is not the story that you wanted them to tell, but I think...
Look, you guys heard my preview podcast where I said, boy, gee whiz, I hope they don't do this bullshit thing where Dany goes to war with Jon because she's jealous about him being King of the North. Like, that was the one thing I'm like, I really hope they don't do that. And even in episode one, I'm like, oh, I think they're going to... So, like, I can't now lie and be like, oh, is... I'm 100% behind it. And like what Kim said last week in the spoiler, it is kind of thrilling to just not know what the fuck is going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
But like I said, even then, I think they are not doing themselves any favors in certain scenes trying to tell the story. Like, they're so good at some of the stuff. And it just makes the stuff that is lackluster kind of stand out.
Sure.
Especially since that's the stuff that, like, they're really wanting the eyeballs. Like, look at this. fucking ship with a crossbow half its size mounted to the bow. How cool is that? And it's got like suckers on the arms of the ballista because it's Greyjoy's, and it looks so fucking cool. And he's got all, it's bristling with sails, and we're shooting a dragon. I said, it's the Death Star trench run. And it's like, yeah, but, you know.
Sure. Yeah, but you could have staged that scene better.
I wanted to thank, before we got started, Highway Superstar. On the podcast. We usually do this once or twice a season. If you don't know who he is, he's the guy who wrote the amazing 80s send-up of the Game of Thrones theme that we have opened up our podcast for, like, low these last 4 years. So if you would like to check it out, there's always a link to his SoundCloud profile at the bottom of our every one of our Game of Thrones posts. He was real cool letting us use his theme. And,
yeah, it's great. Great theme.
No, I love it. It's one of the things I think
we have one of the hottest themes.
It's very
in
distinctive.
All of Westerosi coverage.
There's a lot of people, and a lot of people slicing and dicing the Game of Thrones theme, and likes it, lots of different arrangements. And I'm so glad he's able to, or he was willing to let us adorn our podcast with it. So thanks, and check his SoundCloud profile out. Before we get into the episode, I want to do some housekeeping. This is your last opportunity. You've been putting it off. Now is the final countdown to the end of our 25% off both new and renewal memberships, annual memberships on the club at club.baldmove.com. You got a few hours left to get it if you're hearing this now. So check that out if you want to lock in those savings. Also, celebrating Game of Thrones, we're continuing to do our Super Serious Film Fest Fantasy Edition on Wednesday. We have a little movie called Dragonheart, starring a animated dragon voiced by Sean Connery. Mm-hmm. We have both the podcast, the enhanced video podcast on youtube.com/baldmove, as well as a live watch where we actually watch it with you if you're a club member. There's a little show came out that you're probably familiar with if you watch a lot of HBO, and you probably do. Chernobyl, which is a dramatization miniseries about the immediate aftermath of the disaster of Chernobyl. I watched the first hour of it last night, and it is amazing. Jim and I kind of like this, the science, political, sociological disaster type of topic, and we're going to be talking about it on Wednesday. Thursday, Detective Pikachu comes out, and for some reason, we're going to review it. We're being put to it by our wives and lovers. But we will talk about Detective Pikachu on Thursday. Got results.
Does your wife know about your lover?
She listens to this podcast. Edit this out.
Oh, sorry.
Last week I had a survey to help us select the chapter to give away for Gods of Thrones, and I got the survey results, and it was Seeing Green, the chapter about Stark spirit squirrels and supersized specimen. It's essentially the cultures and peoples of the North. It's a good one. I've actually got that exported, and I'm uploading it right now. There'll be a link to it in the show notes, and of course you can find all that on godsofthrones.com. Also, I will announce the winners on social media. I've contacted them, but I haven't heard back from them all, so if they're cool with me sharing their names, I'll give them credit for that. Pin-y.com is the site where we're housing our exclusive enamel pin designs. Is a very limited edition house snow pin. There's only 15 left. Jump on that at pin-y.com if you want in on that. There's also a stairwood design of Bran's face on a weirwood that's got some availability left as well. They're both very sharp-looking pins. So sharp you could actually probably poke your finger with them.
Careful.
I mean, they're pins after all. Check them out at pin-y.com. And finally, there will be no Twitch stream on Wednesday at twitch.tv/baldmove because Cecily and I finally have gotten a schedule conflict on that night. We'll be back next week. And if you just want to catch up on the action, there's plenty of videos to watch at twitch.tv/baldmove. And they're all archived at youtube.com/baldmove.
Here are the highlights coming up this week on Bald Move.
We've got lots of ongoing coverage this week, from book versus show comparisons for Hot D to the latest very special episode of Why Is Mr. Feeny a Car? But there are a couple of main events this week you need to know about.
Firstly, we've got a brand new commission podcast out this Tuesday covering The Raid 2, sometimes subtitled Retaliation. If you're a fan of martial arts films, this is one you don't want to miss. Iko Uwe is a rising star in the action movie world, and it's easy to see why. Join us on Tuesday as we dive into the bigger, badder sequel to The Raid, try and figure out which is better.
Then on Thursday, we're covering the season finale of Hulu's excellent period drama, Shogun. We've been waiting all season to see what Toranaga-sama's plan is, or if he even has one. It all comes down to this, and we couldn't be more excited. Join us on Thursday for what's sure to be an epic Shogun season finale podcast, and to find out if we plan to cover any related materials.
You can find these and many other great podcasts by searching for Bald Move Pulp or Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app.
Getting geared up for the 6th annual Summer Badass Fest. And while we're working on a slate of apex badass films to enjoy, we've got an early action-packed announcement to make.
Just like last year, we're kicking off badass season with a live movie watch and podcast recording. We've rented out a theater for connoisseurs of action films and Bald Move fans that just want to have a great time.
Unlike last year, this year's movie is top secret. Hush, hush. No hints. Except, it's incredibly badass. It stars an absolute icon of the genre. We're willing to bet most of you haven't seen it, and it's going to be an incredible viewing experience with a packed house of Bald Movers.
Those of you who came to last year's screening of Total Recall know what a party it was. And those of you who didn't, now's your chance to experience it. Meet me and Jim. Order some custom movie-themed drinks at the theater's full bar. Then watch us record the full podcast for the movie. We reserved a venue over twice the size as last year, but seating is still limited.
It's happening Friday, June 21st at 7 p.m. in our hometown of Cincinnati. Get full details and buy tickets at baldmove.com/live.
Cincinnati's actually a pretty great city to visit, and we've got lots of details for side adventures on our event page as well. The Reds are playing the Boston Red Sox in their fantastic Riverside Stadium. The thrills of Kings Island just minutes away, and I'll be leading a kayak trip down the scenic Little Miami River on Saturday.
Again, get full details and get your tickets now on our Badass Fest 6 page at baldmove.com/live.
Okay, let's get into the episode. We start with the survivors at Winterfell mourning their lost loved ones, and John gives a big speech honoring them. A pretty powerful speech. Essentially saying, you know, we are the memory of Westeros, or at least Bran. I expect him to look over at Bran at any moment. You got that? Mm-hmm. You got that? Because, you know, we're mere mortals. You got that memory thing going. Yeah, just saying, remember all these people.
Plus, he gets that, like, distinctively John cadence in his voice that I always like that with the shields that guarded the realms of men. Like, the realms of men.
Yeah.
Like, it's so, I think it's really cool, and it's also fun to, like, just, like, start narrating your shopping list in that.
No, at times it approaches like,
we are going to require a dozen, eh?
No. like a Shatner-esque quality, yeah, with the way little, he breaks up the dialogue.
Yeah, like if he was born in the Highlands of Scotland, that's what James T. Kirk would sound like.
Right. I definitely noticed it.
I really liked Sansa slipping that direwolf sigil hairpin into his armor, kind of like, you know, spiritually adorned. Anointing not Ramsay, Theon as a Stark in death. I thought that was great. You know, I've said many times, I think Emilia Clarke struggles with that grief, but I think she really did a great job grieving over Jorah, and just seeing like the mountain of dead that they're burning kind of shows the sacrifice that's going to go on. Now they're going to undercut this later by saying it's only really half of everyone that died instead of like 97%, but. That speech was great, and it's all about, and it's very ironic in a bitter kind of sweet, or I guess mostly bitter kind of way that John is giving a speech that's a homily on setting aside your differences and working for the greater good and not for any kind of advancement or any, but just to protect people, so that give their lives so that others might live. And yet the rest of the episode is going to be everyone flagrantly forgetting all that and going. I mean, I don't know. Like, I think Varys thinks he's doing the right thing.
Yeah.
But I mean, this is all just ripping this alliance apart the rest of the episode.
Absolutely. It should be a moment of like, oh no, look how fucked up Ghost got. And I bet like it would be great to see John sort of nursing Ghost's wounds, right, and you know, treating him like the loyal direwolf pup that he's been the whole time. Mm-hmm. But we're not going to get that this episode.
No.
So seeing Ghost in this first scene, I'm like, yes. And then by the end, I was like, oh.
So
poor
remember
Ghost.
When I was saying all that thing about like, if we only see 30 seconds of Ghost, we riot. Like, mm-hmm. I don't know. I guess I'm too big of a pussy to riot.
Next episode is all Ghost.
It's all Ghost?
All Ghost, yeah.
No, what you're going to find out is John actually cut off Ghost's ear as a memento. And uh-huh. He's going to have it on his belt to remind him of. That's how
it's
he misses
the thing
ear.
That's keeping him alive now. Is the, yes. That severed ear.
Yes.
So we move over to this feast that they're having in Winterfell with half their army dead. I guess there's so much food that they can just, you know, chow down, really enjoy themselves.
Yeah, I mean, just so many less mouths to feed.
Absolutely.
Like, roll out the wine and the mead and the ale and the finest cuts of mutton.
Uh-huh.
Chops of mutton.
I don't quite know how to cover the scene because, like I said earlier, it sort of just roams around and you feel like you're just a spectator at this feast, sort of going between groups, right?
Yeah.
Like flitting through the crowd,
I'm
right?
I'm fine with just going from group to group. It'd probably be quicker or so, however you want to do it, man.
Okay, well, I'm just going to take it sort of piece by piece here. Like it won't be in particularly chronological order, but okay. Close. So Dany makes Gendry an official Baratheon, as well as the Lord of Storm's End.
All right. Stop there.
Yes, this is important.
How do you grade her politics on this?
I think she is playing an excellent game here.
Really?
Yes. However, I think if you look at... So the thing, there's been something about Dany this entire series mm-hmm. that has been sort of sticking in my craw with mm-hmm. her. And I finally think I understand that it is just her demeanor in general. Because in this scene, she's doing something that is great, you know, and should ingratiate her to everyone. And she only gets about halfway there because she starts this off mm-hmm. with fear. I mean, she's playing this card of, I am a fearsome woman. I am potentially able to smite you any right. second I choose.
For some imagined slight from the past that you had nothing to do with.
Right. And she plays that card at the beginning of this, right. and it doesn't feel right.
It's very Joe Pesci. Well, am I a clown?
Yeah.
Am I amusing
absolutely.
To you? Like, she's, it's...
But she does this in every single interaction she has
yeah.
with anyone, other than maybe John.
Yeah, and Sansa, she tried to butter...
And she did that with John at the
for
first.
For, like, the first couple... Yeah, you're right. It is a flaw. And so my grading of her politics is like, okay, because it's tough to say because the Northern are a fractious lot prone to take offense about anything, but I think her rewarding a southern bastard with a southern title at this feast where it's like honoring the largely northern sacrifices and Essosian sacrifices mm-hmm. I thought it was weird. Like I think maybe she should have started with like looking at the north. Like there's a couple, you know, we know that the sure. last hearth is could we give that to a wildling or at least offer it to them? Could we give it to a northern lord, like a lesser lord or a, I just felt like it was odd. But then again, I started thinking like, how could Dany do that without pissing off the northerners? Because she starts slicing and dicing
giving
the
away their lands
and giving away to people that like maybe not everyone's sure about. It's mm-hmm. like, oh, this is that guy's second cousin to Ramsay Bolton. You don't want like the answer is they probably should have talked about this before the feast or like, hey, I want to give you know, there's a couple clear heroes here, we gotta butter their bread so everyone else knows it's coming. But clearly this was just a lark that she did.
Well, it's a very calculated one.
It is.
It's calculated. Which is what I like about it.
It seems unfortunately calculated to shore up the places she'd already be strong in. Mm. You know, like yeah. like the Targaryens were never that popular up north. And the north has really never been popular with anybody except themselves. So.
Sure. I think it's also just a demonstration of general generosity, right? Mm-hmm. Like she wants these people to see her in a new light and see that if they are loyal to her, they'll be rewarded. Mm-hmm. So I think, like, yes, it may not be the perfect gesture here, but it is one that I think, you know, despite her demeanor at the beginning of it, goes a fair bit of a way to say this queen will help the people yeah. if she's given the opportunity. And you know, the North is not just going to accept her because she gives a fucking castle to some bastard.
Sure.
Like, that's not going to happen.
Right. It's just all about building, like...
But it you have to start somewhere,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, when there's bad blood, you have to start building, like, a string of successes, like a string of pearls, you know? Like, it's got to start... There's got to start the first pearl, you know? And usually it's the person that's kind of in a position of strength that has to offer that. Tyrion thought it was a good political move. Sansa was pissed.
Dude, I love this. This is what I mean when I say this kind of harkens back to Game of Thrones of yesteryear. This is characters being, you know, familiar with the game and using the things that they've learned in the past to inform their future decisions. And, like... you know, Sansa is not this little bird anymore.
No, she's...
She is under the tutelage of Littlefinger for the longest time, and now she is essentially Littlefinger with more of a heart, probably.
Right. She's more of a moral center. I put her right on par with Varys, probably above Tyrion right now. Tyrion just is his... I mean, he telegraphs it this episode. Like, he's not... He's abandoning his better judgment in favor for loyalty, and at least that's what he said, so...
I do wonder, they don't make it explicit, and if they were going for it, they probably would have, so maybe this is not intended, but I do wonder if Tyrion is aware that Sansa, because in this scene, Tyrion takes note of Sansa taking note of what Dany does, and the strategy behind it. Mm-hmm. So later on, when Sansa goes, oh, by the way, you know, my brother is actually the ruler, rightful ruler of the Seven Kingdoms, like, he's got to think in the back of his mind, why is she telling me this? And it's not just out of some sense of loyalty, he shouldn't assume that.
Right.
So I think Tyrion is a little bit off his game if he doesn't get that.
Yeah, no, I think you're right.
So Davos tries to come to terms with Melisandre's prophecy by chatting with Tyrion. I don't know. He seems to have, you know, some regret over the idea that he was looking to kill her and that she helped.
Well, I mean, yeah, what the fuck? Like,
this has been a long, arduous journey with prophecies and the Red Woman and, like, Davos, man, where's his head at?
Right. No, it's like, I have sympathy for a guy who's like, this is a bunch of bullshit, this religion, this person's a charlatan, and she's evil, and then turns out, oh, actually, everything she said is true. She had a kind of, the show wants us to believe, instrumental, you know, part in bringing about the end of the Long Night, like... That would, I mean, it'd be like me coming to grips with like an inconvertible proof that there is like a Judeo-Christian omniscient, omnipotent God.
Mm-hmm.
That would be a real mind bender for me to wrap my head around. So like, I get it, man. I get it. But is this also this is the underline for like the slower members of the audience? Hey, this is what we're dealing with going forward. We dealt with them. Now it's just us and problems that. We can have.
Which, in my opinion, are far more interesting.
Sure.
Then Tyrion admires Bran's wheelchair and his lack of desire.
It's a 120-year-old design. You probably aren't familiar with it.
Yeah.
Made it from reclaimed salvaged driftwood from White Harbor, and it's been responsibly sourced from only weirwood branches that have fallen off the tree. He's very full-blown wheelchair hipster here.
For sure. So Danny's pretty dismayed with how much the North loves the Starks, and maybe more specifically Tormund loves the Starks. He's really fawning over Jon here. So she leaves the party and Varys follows.
I think Tormund does have a no-shit crush on Jon Snow.
It seems like it, yeah.
Yeah.
Has a man crush on him, sure.
He talks a lot about how, what was the sportscaster in Ron Burgundy? Like, you know, whenever he's in his cups and he's like, I just missed your musk. It's like, okay, yeah, there's actually, this is beyond bro. There's a romantic component here.
I saw him ride the dragon. No, I saw him ride the dragon.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a really funny scene, and just the way he's sloshing his beverage.
The horn of Vale is going everywhere.
So
it's great.
So good. Okay, Brienne, Jaime, Tyrion, and Pod are playing a drinking game, which eventually leaves Brienne embarrassed about being a virgin, and Jaime follows her as she sulks off to her room.
It's interesting because I don't know. For this universe, should it be shocking that Brienne, an unmarried, highborn lady, would be a virgin?
I don't think so.
I'm trying to think, like, what the showrunners are saying, like... there's the expectation everyone kind of like the expectation of knighthood is no one really observes that. Mm-hmm. So like, or that was a surprise, like Jaime and Tyrion thinking, oh well, yeah, she's a knight, she's probably, who gives a you know. And also we kind of expect the if we're really being honest, all the lords and ladies are probably having little dalliances and whatnot, like,
yeah.
But it was weird for this. It'd be like going to puritanical, like early America, and someone being like, yeah. "Oh, you're a virgin? What the fuck?" You know, it's like, "Well, aren't we all supposed to be? Like, none of us are married. What's going on?"
Yeah, fair. I really love drunk Tyrion. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't know, something about what Peter Dinklage is bringing in the acting really does it for me. He's just like a wild beast when he gets drunk.
Yeah.
And he's living it up and having a good time.
I like him and Jaime teaming up together to like wall off Tormund from advancing.
Oh, yeah. That's the other part of the scene. Tormund sort of bemoans his lost love to the Hound and immediately finds another woman to keep him company. So he kind of gets over it pretty quick. But yeah, it's a funny moment between him and Jaime, because Jaime doesn't say much. She's just, you know.
And hats off to Tormund for not being a dick about it. Like, hey, the woman rejected you. Move on. None of this friend zone shit.
He does talk about how, like, Jaime came up and stole her.
Oh,
and I'm
sure.
Like, dude, you never had. You can't.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know?
Bran never had anything for you.
He's thinking. Thoughts aren't treason.
Mm-hmm. But his line, which one of you cowards shit in my pants, is hilarious.
So good.
So Pod ends up with, I think, the Hound's girl.
Did you see he actually hooked up there in the whole background of him and Sansa talking? Pod is hooking up a threesome.
Yes.
He's got his lady and he's like, hey,
I think he took the Hound's rejected lady. Yeah.
Yeah.
And he's off.
The legend grows.
It sure does. Probably also, to try one of those Myrinese knots, if I had to guess.
Also, we talked about this on our lunch, with the club members, but it came to our attention that there are female fans grabbing this poor kid by his junk.
Yeah, fuck that.
For photo ops and stuff.
That's
hands off Pod's rod. Yeah. All right? This is a character he plays. Even if he was the character he played, it's still not cool to come up and grab someone's dick. All right? Can we just like keep our hands for ourselves at these fan guns? Is that too much to ask? Please.
Yeah. All right, so the Hound tells Sansa that she could have avoided all of her sorrows if she had left King's Landing with him, but she kind of takes the opposite view. She believes all those sorrows have made her stronger, made her into the person she needed to be Lady of Winterfell.
Yeah, it's too bad that she, like, I mean, I see why she says that, but, like, there's this idea that you have to have, like, you know, abuse and trauma to be, like, a strong-tempered person.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know.
I think she's been listening too much to Bran.
Yeah.
He's probably been saying that. Like, right. Everything that's happened has brought you here.
It's brought you to... Yeah, I mean, that's great. I mean, that's a great way to... That's a good survivor speak, I guess. It's just like, you know, I don't want anyone to think that they have to be put through the meat grinder like she did and to be a competent leader or to be a person who has worth in this world. But yeah, like, I thought it was like the fact that, like, the Stark girls are the ones that make the Hounds, like, smile, I think is interesting. But it's also frightening because it tells you, like, to reach his level of, like, you know, mirthless black humor, they had all the things that they had to go through. But it's left them able to communicate with him in a unique way.
Yeah, I would say they have one of the few or two of the few connections to the Hound. Mm-hmm. He has very little connection with anyone. There's one thing that he wants, and he doesn't say what it is. He said it's none of Sansa's business. There are two possibilities in my mind. One is pretty obvious.
Mm-hmm.
We got a confrontation with the Mountain, hopefully coming up.
There's a button for this, Jim.
No, there's no button.
There's no button.
Well,
it's still broke.
There is, but it's not going to come through on this.
Jesus
thing.
Christ! The button's only working when we're alone. I'm starting to think I'm being gaslit here. It's a figment of my imagination. The Clegane Bowl, we call it. Yes.
You said it. I think if we say it two more times, it's going to be real.
Okay.
And the other thing is possibly death.
Yeah.
I mean, I could see the Hound just wanting to be done with it, you know?
I think his unfinished business in the Capitol in a later scene shows where he's wanting this to go.
But I don't know if he cares too much about the outcome.
I don't know. Maybe they'll subvert our expectations by not having it happen at all.
Maybe.
The Hound will slip on a bridge. There's a little... his horse, the Stranger, will slip on a piece of mossy stone. tumbling into a creek.
Gutter,
and his horse's armor is going to keep him from being able to effectively swim. We saw that with Jamie. And there's going to be no Bronn to jump in and save him.
Mm-hmm. Arya can't pull him out of there.
Expectation subverted.
I do like... There's another... You know, a bit of good writing here with these little bird callbacks. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of sprinkled throughout this entire episode with just nice little callbacks and really good dialogue. So then Gendry finds Arya and tries to use his new title to woo her into marriage. Arya says she's never been a lady and refuses his proposal.
Yeah, I mean, that is essentially the payoff to the scene with Nymeria, where she realizes that Nymeria is not going to... She's been a wild direwolf, you know, running roughshod on all the Freys and Lannisters in the Riverlands, killing whom she wants. Like, she's not going to want to curl up beside a fire in Winterfell beneath Arya's feet. And Arya's the same way. Like, she doesn't, like, what he... I mean, she could teach Gendry to be a lord, but then she'd have to be his lady, and she doesn't want to sit around doing needle points and wearing frilly collars and all that shit.
Yeah.
I don't know what...
She's like, got a different point.
I wonder, you know, what she wants for herself. Like, if she is able to kill Cersei or all the things, all the rights are wrong. Because she also talks a lot about, hey, we're family and we owe things to each other. Like, what does she feel her obligations are towards... You know, the family. Like, if all the enemies were slain, is there a place for her anywhere?
That's a really good question. I don't know. I'm not even sure she knows.
Yeah.
It seems right now she's pretty focused on the one mission she does have currently, which is to kill Cersei.
Right. Because there's certainly, you can find pairings of lords and ladies in Westerosian history that are very unconventional.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, I think that, especially post the Long Night, where there's so many people dead and there's so many lords and ladies, there's going to be so many, there's going to be so many people that are like, kind of like Novu nobility that don't know how to act. Like, I feel like this is a time where you could really fly your freak flag pretty high if you wanted to be, you know, wear leather pants and stab people and get in pirate adventures and fulfill assassin contracts. And as long as you came home every couple of months and warmed Gendry's bed, if you so desire. Like, I think that you could work out something like that is what I'm saying. I think Gendry'd be open to that.
Yeah, I think so.
Not an open relationship, like an open to killing people relationship, an open to adventure relationship.
My biggest question around Gendry as Lord of Storm's End is, who the fuck is going to live in his castle?
What do you mean his castle? Storm's End?
Storm's End.
I don't...
assumingly, at like half the people on this continent are dead.
Oh, I see what you're saying.
He has no, like... family that he is gonna like maintain or live in this castle with him. What does a castle with Gendry at the head look like?
He falls in with the wrong maester and wrong Castilian. They just rob him blind, and
it's a cautionary tale.
It's like those football players that get the multi-million dollar contracts and then fall into the wrong people, and it's like, where'd my money go? I'm like, he needs to find someone with a good head on his shoulders that he can trust. I wonder who that'd be.
Davos. Bring Davos with you.
Yeah.
Davos could get it.
Come on,
done.
Old man. I need you to be my Castilian, and you essentially got a good gut. You say yay or nay on all the people that I need to run this castle.
And he's great at establishing relationships with other lords and ladies. So.
Maybe that's one of the spinoff ideas. It'll just be Gendry, Misadventures, and Running Storm's End. It's like a fucked up Downton Abbey.
That would be pretty amazing. All right, we move over to Jaime entering Brienne's room to end this game that they started. And he also ends up entering her as well. Very sexy scene.
This is what I wanted to see. So, like, I got no criticisms with this.
Like,
my only minor criticism is the idea that, like, maybe Jaime and Brienne have to get inebriated to work up the courage to do it. Like, that was a little odd. Like, what does that say about Jaime? What does that say about Brienne? But, you know, it's kind of par for the Westeros course. That I think it's more of like, I don't know. What is the deal with that?
Well, I mean, let's not criticize it. Let's praise it. I think this is a great scene, and I think there's a lot of so I think this is a weird situation for both of them.
Yeah.
Because Jaime probably has some residual feeling for Cersei.
Sure. This is a rebound.
Right.
Which is dangerous.
He's about to take this woman's virginity,
which
she's willingly going to give him. I mean, it's not like weird or anything, but.
Right.
You know, it's a big moment for Brienne.
Right.
They share some kind of connection which hasn't been physical in the past. Like, this is a weird moment for both of them.
And the way they best relate is, like, the whole, oh, you're keeping it too hot in here. Piss off. You know, it's like it's very, how do you turn the corner from that to,
yeah.
You know?
Well, Jaime's so fucking smooth in this scene.
Yeah.
I mean,
I guess that's what
it's
thought.
A
it's
little
like,
transparent with him going, oh, so hot in here, so hot in here. But when, like, she's talking about, oh, you're sounding a little bit jealous. And he's going, I do sound jealous, don't I?
Yeah.
Like, that's a really good line.
Yeah, yeah.
That is a damn good line, Jaime.
Yeah. I mean, like I said, it's an embarrassment of riches. So I guess I'm only like, obviously I consulted my fan fiction and it didn't go exactly like that. So there was a little bit of kind of, you know.
Yeah.
I was really happy to see this happen. And of course, it just makes it all the worse how this ends up at the end of the episode.
Yeah. I feel so good for Brienne here.
Be careful what you wish for, fans, because they might do it and then subvert it.
All right, Danny begs John not to tell anyone about his ancestry, as it will inevitably lead to him being chosen as the king. He says that he absolutely must tell his family, and Danny is pissed. So a lot of people, I think, are assuming or reading into this and thinking John promised her he wouldn't say anything. I think the exact opposite happened, and he told her that he has to say something.
Well, I think this was an ultimatum that this couple made, and John decided to violate it. Like,
yeah.
She's like,
no, she
he didn't
gave
say,
him an ultimatum,
he
for
didn't
sure.
promise, and, you know, he didn't say he was definitely going to, and she didn't say it was going to be right. She's like, look, he's like, we can live together. She's like, yeah, I told you how. Mm-hmm. This is the framework in which we can live together.
Right.
But, I mean, it is, it's so crazy because, like, you know, there are excuses for all of this. It's just frustrating for me that Dany, after all she's been through, is just nakedly jealous of the fact that John is loved by his people more than she is. Mm-hmm. Like, it'd be so weird, like, what, like, if the Dothraki and the Unsullied were, like, putting John on their shoulders and huzzahing him, and she's like, oh, plenty of people looked at me this way, but none over here. I'm like, well, no shit. What have you done besides kick their ass in a field of fire and burnt their leaders to death in a shocking display, apparently, of Westerosi barbarianism? Like, read Fire and Blood, Danny. Like, read your own family's history. You have to do a little bit of taking people's shit and of glad handing and of building alliances. And but she is young, she is inexperienced, and this is a theme for her that she doesn't broke anybody sharing her power or even trying to get on that level with her. So, like, it's not unfair. It's just, again, this is not the story I would have preferred to see.
Yeah, I mean, she definitely comes across in this scene and many others as entitled or feeling entitled. You know, Tyrion says it, you know, she was born essentially with these dragons and she came out of the fire with them. And, like, how could she not believe in destiny?
Right.
And how could that not make her feel a little bit entitled also?
Sure. Yeah.
And that's the thing that always puts me off on Dany is just how entitled she is. She doesn't feel like she needs to earn anything,
right?
Because she has everything that makes her the rightful queen.
No, I mean, like, I was watching this episode, like, when Varys said the first time, like, well, maybe you shouldn't find the people that want to be king to make them king. Mm-hmm. And I remember when I was like 13 or so, I read his Ray Bradbury short story about, like, a science fiction future where essentially, like, all the government decisions are invested into a single person, and that person, like every time, like, when you become 18, like, you take this rigorous, like, psychological profile and intelligence tests and all that stuff, and it's, like, staved, and then, like, people are drafted to become this person for, like, 1 year, and you don't get a choice. They just, like, come to your door and, like, yep, you are going to be the person that makes all decisions because we've screened you, and you're in, and also one of the screening is the person really doesn't want to be that.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, I've always thought, like, boy, the way we do elections, which is essentially like 18-month-long celebrity fawning fests, puffing up people's ego, getting a bunch, like, hundreds of millions of dollars, is like the way to elect a sociopath to be.
Yeah.
It seems obvious from my way of thinking that John would be the better king.
Mm-hmm. No, I agree with
they both have the destiny. Maris, they both have the miracles. They both have the long history of saving people. But Danny adds a level of like almost, you know, like divine right that John, like even this thing when Tormund's trying to put that on his shoulders, like, oh, you even got murdered, you wouldn't stop. He's like, well, I didn't have any say about that. Like someone else brought me back. I didn't like will myself to open my eyes. He does, and I don't know. I feel like in my perfect Game of Thrones, if they wanted to go this path, I would be scratching my head about like, oh, Danny's got her, but Jon's got her, and I don't know who I'm rooting for, but I'm on Team Jon Snow.
Yeah, I mean, it's Jon's humility, honestly, that wins the day. Like, right. I don't want someone who is full of themselves.
The man knows nothing. He doesn't even know how great of a leader he is. Like, it's great. Yeah,
I think so. But we'll see. I guess we'll see what happens with Dany and what choice she ultimately makes, but it doesn't bode well in this episode.
Yeah.
So Dany's forces tally their losses. They're now on even footing with Cersei. Dany's losing patience, and everyone does what they can to keep her from burning King's Landing.
Mm-hmm.
The plan becomes to conduct a siege of King's Landing and show the people that Cersei is their true enemy. Sansa suggests they give their armies time to recover, but Jon sends them anyway. And they'll march the armies down the King's Road, and Dany will head to Dragonstone. And Jaime will remain in King's Landing as a guest.
Yeah. So here's a scene I think is the one of the weaker parts of storytelling. Well, I don't know. Maybe it's the stronger part if you want to think that Dany's just a pig-headed idiot. But, like, literally every one of her advisors, every one of them are saying that your enemies grow weaker by the moment. And you will grow stronger if you have some patience and, like, maybe we can get this guy from Dorne to pledge. And she's like, no, no, no. And she actually says the complete opposite. She, like, sums all of her counsel and says the complete opposite. The longer I leave my enemies alone, the stronger they become. And that is profoundly frustrating. It's like to go around and have every one of your advisors say, and then the person on top says, nah, I'm going to reject your reality and substitute my own. That is super, super frustrating.
Yeah.
And John kind of like, I feel like there is a point here where John could maybe push back a little bit and been like, come on, you know, like this isn't just Sansa wanting. And Sansa had a perfect, like when she's like, oh, you're just dragging your feet. I'm like, no, I'm not. Like, yeah, half of your armies are supermen, super soldiers, and never hunger or tire, apparently. But the Dothraki don't, like, they're just, you know, that they're just dudes. And, like, all of my people are dudes, and they need to sleep and eat and rest. And what's so funny is, like, when they roll down to King's Landing, Qyburn throws this into Tyrion's face. Mm-hmm. Like, our troops are well-rested and ready to go, and you're a bunch of ragtag marching on their bellies, dumb fucks. And it's like, yeah, Qyburn's got you dead to rights.
Yeah. I feel like that was bound to happen anyway with how far they have to march. But it does take place in the course of a single episode. So maybe it wasn't so bad.
Right.
The other slightly disappointing thing here is to find out how many people they have left after the battle with the Night King.
The Dothraki especially.
Yeah, it shocked me to hear that they would have even footing with Cersei.
Like there's like the way that the whoever the Dothraki Khal is now, that's like the leader of the forces, the way he kind of like goes and like with a shame face takes half his... I don't think you're ashamed that you lost half your men. I think you're ashamed that you're actually hiding the losses. Like, you know, like he's trying to pull a quick one. Like, we only lost half our dudes too. I saw four guys ride back from that. I saw all lights extinguished. Four guys rode back from that.
Yeah. And one ghost.
Four out of 25,000 or whatever.
One of them was Jorah.
Is more than half or is less than half. But again, that's what I'm saying. Like, the story itself is not so bad. They're just doing a bad, like, at the end of that episode, last episode, we both thought that, like, this is like a 90%, this is a Pyrrhic victory. This is a 90% loss type of situation. And now it's half, and it just so happens to be they're now on even footing with King's Landing. That's...
Yeah, a little frustrating.
Yeah, you hear the click-clack of keyboards when he of the people writing the scenes when you start to hear stuff like that.
Yeah. So Sansa and Arya take Jon aside to sort of interrogate him on his loyalty to Dany. Jon defends his decision, reminding them of his oath that he made to Dany. When Arya calls, Jon, you know, includes him in being one of the last of the Starks. Jon decides to tell them both about his ancestry and makes them swear never to tell anyone.
Mm-hmm.
I
Oh, so you're only half a Stark like we thought all along. Ah, this changes everything.
No, I love this scene, though. It's there are very small moments in here that make it just delicious to me. Like when John, you know, she calls him last of the Starks and John just kind of bows his head and then looks over Bran.
This is where this, my dad.
And Bran's just like, it's your choice. Yeah. You know, it's like, I don't know. I just think it's a perfect line. And then when Arya steps in to try to convince him, no, we love you, John. You are actually a Stark.
Yeah.
You are as much Stark as we are. Knowing what we know, like, those lines are so good.
Yeah. I thought it's interesting Arya's middle position of, like, respect for Dany, but, like, she respects their sacrifice but doesn't value it enough to respect their commitments as an ally, it seemed like. Like, what?
Yeah. And then not so much that he would, that they would put her over the family.
It's just so weird because everyone acts like marriage alliances aren't a thing that has ended many, many a war and countless squabble in this kingdom. And but that's the other part of the story that I don't.
Well,
that I feel like
Tyrion doesn't.
They're not telling a good enough job is the fact that I think Dany and Jon just have the classic, oh, I just found out you're my aunt kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Like oh, this is it's like it's just gross the thought of it. And does that feel realistic to you?
I don't know. I mean, that's not nearly as much of a thing in the North as it is a Targaryen thing, right?
Well, I'm not talking about the incest. I'm just saying, like, in real life, if, like, you found out that, like, these people were dating and they're in their 20s and they're through, like, one of them was adopted, kind of like and the other person's from another country, and they come together and, like, they're dating 6 months and then someone comes in and says, like, oh, actually, we looked at the and you guys are totally, like, aunt and nephew. Like, does the average person be like, oh, Jesus Christ, this changes everything I think about this person? Or do they, or they're like, well, that was information I could have used a long time ago. But, like, especially since Dany said I can't have children.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't, maybe I'm, like, a little bit too libertine, but, like, I don't.
Maybe you
that
just
seems
gotta
like
keep
an inhuman reaction to be, like, you're in the middle of, like, kissing this person you're passionate love with. And just the thought that, like, oh. And it's not like, you know, Dany's not convinced, like, you know, she's not, like, 35 years older than him. It's like, I don't know. I don't know. Especially since everything has taught me that, like, this thing is not seemingly a big a taboo, especially amongst Targaryens. I thought it was weird. I thought it's weird that seems to be the thing that's really, you know, they almost got together and then it's just like, ah, your kid, I can't, your lip stays like aunt. Your lip stays like nephew.
Tyrion doesn't seem to think it's a huge problem because he's trying to pair them up anyway, right?
Well, and Varys is the whole time like, oh, but Jon's from the North, and he's like, okay.
Yeah.
I mean,
so Varys is making a big deal. Tyrion is not. I'm not really sure where they're trying to come down on that with the show because Dany and Jon haven't really discussed it, right?
Like, well, there are some looks they're kissing that they're giving. Off. I think that was like.
But it could also be the tension of just, like, who's going to rule. Like, we've got a big problem to solve here, and we can't keep doing this until we figure it out.
The only reason I think it's the personal revulsion is because it's brought up with Tyrion and Varys when they're discussing. Like, that was, like, the, well, it's like, they don't do even want to get married now they know their aunt and nephew. Like, okay. I mean, I don't know. I thought that's, of all the things I thought would split Dany and Jon apart, I know there was a couple people that emailed last, well, what if they find out their aunt? And I'm like, well, come on. Like, this is Westeros. This is a completely different way of looking at it. They didn't know Dany can have kids. Like, that's the whole, you know, if you look at the foundational reason for why there's a taboo about how you know, like, aside from all the power disparities and abuse of, like, trust and there's which don't apply in this situation, it's all about, you know, essentially genetic diversity. If you fuck your brother and sister all the time, then you're gonna breed yourself out of existence, essentially. Since I thought the whole Dany being barren was them being like, green light for incest, kids. I don't know.
All right. We move over to Tyrion ribbing Jaime about being with such a tall woman before the brothers part once again. But Bronn shows up and threatens to kill them both until Tyrion offers him Highgarden. He accepts and he leaves, saying he'll find them when the war is over. He's not coming to fight with him.
Pretty funny scene in the kind of Quentin Tarantino way, just like Bronn, Mr. Wolfing them both, and like,
I've been breaking noses for a long time.
Right,
and that's not what it sounds like.
Yeah,
it's great. I really like this scene.
What purpose do you think it's serving, though?
I think Bronn has some large role to play and some big decision to make here. Like saying, you know, he's going to kind of be watching them.
Right.
I don't expect him to be too far from the battle when it goes down.
Mm-hmm.
I think Bronn's got at least one more thing that he's got to do here.
Mm-hmm.
He's got to pick a side finally.
And like, I think that it's telling that they're, that where he ends with, it's like, my fighting days are over, but I still got a few killing days left. Like that, to me, is foreshadowing that he is going to make a impactful kill.
Yeah.
But the kills that he can make, like, I feel like there's seven levels of dibs on this shit.
There are, yeah. He's not going to kill Cersei.
You know, like imagine, like, a Jaime and Arya and Jon, and everybody is in, like, a race to kill Cersei, and Bronn pops out of the shadows and, like, floop.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, gives him a jaunty salute. And like, that's not going to be cool.
No, it
but
won't.
Some people theorize that, like, it's lighting a fire under Jaime's ass. Like, oh, Cersei wants you dead. I'm like, Jaime doesn't need that. Jaime knows who Cersei is.
Yeah. I didn't read into it at all.
So, I don't know. But the Lord of the Highgarden. And I also think that's also interesting. And I wonder... They're building so much of this stuff up, the fact that there's all these people that don't know what the fuck they're doing becoming lords and ladies. I wonder if we are going to see some, like, scenes at the end, because, I mean, Bronn's right. Like, the fucking... Do you know why it's not called Lannister Rock? It's called Casterly Rock?
Mm-hmm.
Because Lan the Clever fucked the Casterlys out of it way back when, in the mist of time.
Well, like, I mean, this is Bronn's plot in life. Bronn will forever be promised a... slightly bigger thing that he sees as just enough to push him over the edge to switch allegiances. You know, like, that is what Bronn is at his core. He's a mercenary.
But the pyramid scheme's got to stop somewhere, and I just feel like him being Lord of Highgarden is,
well, this,
like,
is why I love this scene so much, because he thought it stopped at River Run. He's like, what the fuck could you possibly offer me?
Right.
Double River Run. Get out of here. And when he says Highgarden...
Yeah.
Bronn goes, oh, shit, you're right.
That's double River Run.
Yeah, yep, that's easily double River Run.
That's actually a little bit better.
I'm kind of confused as to why Jaime is so opposed to it, because I don't know what special place in his heart Highgarden holds.
I think it's just his upper-class prejudice.
Yeah.
Like, you just... Cutthroat will never be Lord of the Reach. Like, again, a Cutthroat was Lord of Castle Rock once upon a time, and that's why you're sitting on it, you asshole. Or you ever sat on it, you asshole, so...
That's fair. But I think Tyrion knows Bronn better than Jaime, certainly. So then we move over to Arya joining up with the Hound, who's on his way to finish some business in King's Landing. Neither of them plans on coming back.
That's surprising. I'm really surprised that, like, Arya's still on, like, a suicide... But no, I mean, there are a few names on her list, and some are bigger than others, and, like, the biggest one of all is Cersei.
I don't know that she's on a suicide mission. I just think she doesn't see herself, you know, essentially being a lady in Winterfell.
Like, not
just
coming...
Just the way she wouldn't be a lady in Storm's End.
But she doesn't have, like... Oh, Jesus. I guess, I don't know. I mean, maybe The idea that Arya couldn't come back to Winterfell and be whatever kind of woman she wanted to be is amazing to me.
No, I think she could. I just don't know if she wants to, like, settle down in this comfortable place, you know?
Never coming back, never. She didn't say, like, I'm never going to live here. Like, I don't want to move in with my dad, but I do visit him regularly, you know? Like,
that's fair.
Like, you're never coming back to the North? Why the fuck would you not ever want to come back? I don't know.
I don't know, but I do love... to see the Arya and Hound Roadshow back on.
No, it's...
That's one of the coolest things this episode did.
Yeah, like, that's... Of all the entertaining traveling roadshows we've had, like, you got Bronn and Tyrion's up there, but the Hound and Arya was very entertaining.
It's unfortunate, because I think this is all we'll see of the roadshow.
Yeah.
With all the time jumps that we had in this episode, they're already at King's Landing.
The next time we see them, they're going to be on that hill that everyone stops on that overlooks, you know, that, like, you know...
Right.
Overlooks King's Landing.
For sure. I don't think we'll see much of it.
Yeah. Bummer.
It is what it is. All right. So Danny watches the injured.
They got to stop at an inn and eat every chicken in the room. They got 5 minutes.
You think
minutes
so?
To
at least
that.
Once? One,
at
one
least,
good
yeah.
scene with him?
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah.
I hope so. So Danny watches the injured Rhaegal get back into the sky. And he gets a moment to show off before his death. And then we move over to Tyrion trying to convince Sansa to cooperate with Danny. Instead, Sansa uses the secret that Jon told her to try to convince him that there's a better option. And this just makes perfect sense. Like, of course, Sansa is going to try and get in you know, dig her claws into the advisors of Danny, try and sow dissent amongst her ranks because she sees what Danny is doing, trying to win over the people of these seven kingdoms out from under her. This makes perfect sense. Plus, I think it's a great scene.
Plus, I think it's super perceptive of Sansa to puzzle out that, like, you're afraid of her.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you're, you know, I'm saying, like, okay, well, like, if we're going to be peaceful, John's going to be warden of the North. So, you know, like, they're going to be have a great relationship. And, you know, and he's like, just, you know, why do you keep provoking her? And I'm like, that's exactly what, like, an abused person says about their lover around their friends and family. Like, why do you have to always provoke them? Like, well... I mean, I'm not saying I want to kill her, or I'm just like, I just distrust this strange person that has these powerful mythical beasts that could turn on us at any time. Like, she needs to build those string of pearls that we keep that we've talked about. And I thought that was very perceptive of her realization that the Tyrion's afraid of her.
Mm-hmm. And that he is not afraid of John. He actually knows John a little bit.
Right.
He understands that he's probably the better choice, but I think Tyrion has a loyalty to Dany because that's kind of where he's placed all his bets at this point.
Yeah.
And
the other thing is, like, also, the whole time I'm watching this, like, Tyrion's trying his best to, like, make some kind of peace brokerage here. But all the time I'm like, I don't think Sansa respects you anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you shit the bed on your analysis of the sister, and now you're trying to tell me how I should feel about my brother and his new girlfriend and how that feels and our position in the North when I just fought for it and won. Like, you know,
and he's not done making mistakes even in this episode.
Yes,
like,
yes.
By the end of it, he's made yet another grievous error. Yeah. And he seems like he's lost whatever magic touch he had in early seasons.
And he's like, it's tragic because he is one of the few people that I think could have been an honest broker here. He, you know, he is afraid of Danny, and he does have a lot of private doubts. And he's also not only afraid of her, but he also knows that his leash with her is very short. So, like, he can't even do what Varys did this episode, which is, like, defy her counsel and wisdom.
Mm-hmm.
Like, the one person that maybe could have, like, had an honest dealing with Sansa and Jon and is hamstrung by his own mistakes, his alleged loyalties to his family, the fact that he's on the outs with Dany. It's tough.
Yeah. Tormund tells Jon that he's taking the free folk back home. Jon asks Tormund to take Ghost with him, and Sam and Gilly tell Jon that they're having a child. And afterward, Jon just totally snubs Ghost.
He ghosts Ghost.
He does. It's really disappointing. Like, I want to say it's sad, but it's not sad in, like, the way that I think they intended. It's more sad that the writers didn't give Jon a moment. Like, a single moment with Ghost to say goodbye.
I think it's worse than that. I think that the writers actually are using this as a way to show that Jon has utterly rejecting his northern heritage and his family in favor. Yeah, because his stated purpose of sacrificing Ghost is like, well, he won't be happy south, so you need to take him up to north. And, you know, like, that is a huge... Like I said, if I knew a guy who gave up his puppy that he'd raised since he's a puppy, and again, putting aside the psychic bond that they have too, the fact that they warg with each other, if I found out my buddy was putting his dog up for adoption because he wanted to move in his girlfriend said no dogs allowed, I that's fucked up. I mean, I think.
Yeah.
Because not just because of what it says about the guy's relationship with the dog, how willing, but also the fact that it says something about, I mean, I know Danny didn't put this as a condition, but like... I don't know. It's you're supposed to feel sad. You're supposed to feel let down because I do feel like narratively this is John reject. But I also don't think that the showrunners or the writers maybe have never owned a dog, because this is a very strong statement you're making here about him. Like, you know, and Ghost is sitting there. He's looking forlorn. He's got his ear, chewed off by some dead fucker. And John's going to not. And the other thing is, like, I think they could have split the difference by John, like, going and hugging Ghost and, like, maybe shedding some tears and them having a moment and, like, Ghost licking the tears. Like, they could have told this in a way that really doesn't make John seem like a fucking villain.
Yeah, 100%.
But they either don't know how serious the relationship between people and dogs are, or they really want us to think that John's a fucking asshole.
They don't make it explicit here, but I assume that Sam and Gilly are headed back to Hornhill.
Yeah, where else would they go?
Yeah.
I also don't know why they're... a lot of this was treated like final goodbyes.
Yeah.
And it kind of bothered me because it feels like the characters know something we don't. Because in a just world that John and Danny are trying to construct, mm-hmm. it ain't nothing for Sam to visit from Hornhill or for the king and queen of the realm to visit Hornhill. Or, yeah. Yeah. So
I think the only one that's probably a mostly permanent goodbye is Tormund, right?
But even then, like, if you've got dragons and you can fly north of the wall and then see them, like, that happens literally all the time in Martin's world when the Targaryens had dragons. That's one of the reasons mm-hmm. they're able to unite the realm, because they could just jet around on these dragons and do these, like, you know, diplomacy missions where it's like every year yeah. we're going to get around and talk to everybody, have dinners and feast with them and all that stuff. Like, why, after all the jetpacking we've seen and how small the realm is, relatively speaking, why are these people acting like after final goodbyes? Answer, this is probably the last time they're going to get a chance on film, so the writer's like, we've got to make it a moment.
I want to give them some credit. Answer, they're going to King's Landing, possibly to die. Like, Sam, you know, Sam saying goodbye to John as John is marching off to battle, I think is a sort of appropriate thing. Like,
yeah, no, you're right. That's a perfect explanation. It's like you're seeing your friend or lover off to war.
Yeah,
you want to see him again.
Yeah,
but
nothing's
given.
Yeah.
All right, I retract all my. I reject all my criticism and replace it with your praise.
All right, we go to the boat to Dragonstone, where Tyrion and Varys discuss what to do with the information about Jon's ancestry. Varys believes the same thing Dany does, that Jon's desire won't matter when it comes to who rules the kingdoms. He will essentially be forced to be king because the people will see him as such.
It is so weird that Jon's given no agency in here, because, like, I'm trying to think of a time where someone has put someone up to a rebellion against a crown and the person, like, steadfastly refused. Like, how does that even work?
It's so weird with John, though, because, like, every time he's been pushed forward in a direction, he's reluctantly followed it. Hmm. Like, you know, when they made him King of the North, he didn't want it. He just, that's who he needed
but he wasn't,
to be in that moment.
He didn't take it from someone, you uh-huh. know? Like, there's, like, yeah. I just feel like that if Varys thinks that he can go to John and be, hey, you know what, John, I've been really thinking about it. Turns out you're the better king, and Dany kind of sucks as a queen. She's crazy.
Yeah, or if
they got a whole bunch of lords to pledge to John, and then they came to him with that deal, and so like that's at best an offer you keep waiting. That's the Omega plan that you keep waiting in the wings. If Dany does go mad queen, like it's mm-hmm. not a ripcord you pull now, but like I feel like in Varys's eyes, he's going to plot treason.
Yeah. Yeah.
And there's two episodes left for him to be found out, discovered, and, you know, probably dealt with. And
this was super exciting to me because it was sort of, you know, subverting my expectations, mm-hmm. which is Tyrion and Varys will come together,
right.
have some moment of brilliance to save everyone in King's Landing. Now it appears they're pitting them against each other. But by the end of the episode, you kind of think Tyrion might move over to Varys' side. Mm-hmm. Like, he's got to know that this could certainly be the final straw for Dany.
Yeah, but there's also, they're not, you know, I just don't understand. I don't know. I think that there's a lot of things that seem like, I like Varys is saying, oh, well, 8 people know, well, that's no longer a secret, it's an information, mm-hmm. and if this gets out, then, you know, the queen's going to lose the North and the Vale, their aunt and nephew, like, there are all these problems of things, and the fact that, you know, that this stuff that's true about Dany, she dislikes her authority being questioned and all that stuff. It is all pretty good, but again, like, Varys, I don't know, like, Varys, like Tyrion points out later, how many kings have you served again? Is it 5 or is it 6? Like, Varys knows how to sweep aside a king if it needs to be, so, like, why does he feel like it has to be now on the eve of another big battle? Like,
I don't know. It's a good question.
I mean, and maybe he's not going, but like, for this to be relevant to the plot, I figure he's going to have to. Like, him feeling Tyrion out about how, like, that's appropriate, but I feel like he's going to go forth and start recruiting for the shadow government, and like, that seems very, very hasty.
I agree. I think it still remains to be seen what kind of Queen Dany is going to be, because despite some of her tendencies, she has not acted on them yet.
Yeah,
I think that's important and crucial. She has listened to the counsel of her people for the most part. Mm-hmm. keeping her from doing the thing that she seems to want to do, the easy route here is just burn everyone. Mm-hmm. She's resisted that impulse, and I think that's a mark in her favor,
right,
as queen. However, this, like I said, this might be the final straw, losing Missandei. And I think, like, is Varys super worried here about just getting right back into the fucking War of the Five Kings? Like, is he just thinking, okay, well, Dany's going to replace Cersei and she's going to have to be fucking dealt with?
I think he's just got a bright line of you can't kill innocent people. Like
sure, I 100% agree with that. But I'm looking at, like, why would he...
Indiscriminately, he's fine with killing, like, teenage girls and Essos when they're about to be married to a cow. Like an indiscriminate death of, like, thousands and thousands of little folk, since he himself was a little folk before he ascended. I think that's his bright line. Like, I can't support a leader that would, for any reason, especially when waiting 6 months can solve this. Now, I do think the show is soft-pedaling, like, the effect of a siege on a city. Like, I mean, we saw it in season two.
Yeah, those people are not going to have a good time.
They're not.
And they're
not people going to
just
starve.
Just going to blame Cersei.
And people are going to get murdered. And, like, if there is a civil war in the capital, that'll be... But, like, it's probably be better than raining dragon fire from the sky.
Yeah. I think less people would die, sure.
Yeah. So is it, like, kind of like, are we debating whether we should drop the bomb on Japan here? Like, you know, like, it's an inhuman thing, but there's arguments on both sides. And, like, if you... do a big cosmic scale, like, 1 million people die here, 10 million people die in the other, so I guess the 1 million, I don't know. I wish the show leaned even more heavily on that and really talked about the politics of, because I feel like that it's kind of like when we talk about leveling sanctions against a despotic regime, it's like, oh, that's the civilized thing to do. Well, you're essentially starving the people, because it's not the despot that's going to be, he's still going to be eating prime rib and pineapple and all that shit. It's people starving, and your best hope is they get so desperate that they depose him. That's not nonviolent. It's maybe less violent than an invasion or war, but
yeah.
I wish the show had a little bit more of that real politic in there.
Well, the thing that I think I'm not communicating super well that I'm trying to get across is, in my opinion, Varys sees this information about Jon as super divisive if Dany is sitting on the throne to the realm. Like, he understands that the ramifications in the realm are no one will accept Dany as the legitimate leader. If Dany gets on the throne, she's essentially going to start this war all over again the way that it was started when Robert Baratheon died, right? Like, this cycle is going to happen again, and so he's trying to prevent that by putting the person with the stronger claim on the throne in the first place.
The problem, I guess,
not even the stronger claim. Like, that's, I don't think that's what's entering his head. It's the person that the realm will accept most.
What if Stannis had just let Renly win? Like, okay, well, I've got the stronger claim, but I actually, for the good of the realm, I'm going to pledge support because you're more charismatic, you're blah, blah. Like, the War of the Five Kings happened because all five people got in their head that, like, now's the time to rebel. Like, I don't know. The situation is analogous here because the one person in your opinion,
totally,
your hopes, doesn't want it, and he'll like,
sure,
let the people love him and let him love, and the people
but someone they don't want has it. Like, I think that's important too, right? The lords are going to not want Dany on the throne if they see somebody else as having a more legitimate claim, and if Dany sits on it and there's someone with a better claim, they're like, well, why the fuck couldn't I have it? Like, if the person with the best claim isn't going to have it anyway, let me go in there and take it. I don't know. I think Varys is reading the realm pretty well talking about backing the right horse. We'll see what happens.
I mean, there's one thing if they're going to go that route, I wish to put a piece of dialogue where Varys is like, look, do you remember that speech I gave about the shadow on the wall and where the real power resides? Mm-hmm. The only reason any of this works is because people do think when things are running properly, there's a succession, there's order. And if you start, like, just dismissing better claims of this or that, then what you're telling all the lords that even more than what, because we all know that really the claim comes down to who's got the most armies, but if you get that idea and, like, everyone starts believing it, then nothing will ever be stable again,
right?
So
I don't know, I'm really curious to see what he does, because I don't honestly see like a huge path forward for him to commit treason. Like, what the hell is he going to do?
Yeah, with who? Because we don't know.
Like, is he going to poison Danny?
Right, and there used to be like half a dozen lords that you knew that he could be conspiring with that like would be right. But now, like, if he's like, oh, I rounded up the nephew of the Dornish person and the third cousin of the Tyrells.
And
there are a bunch
Robin
of fresh-faced
and-
doofuses that we've never seen before. And they've got you. Like, who gives a shit? Yeah. Like... you're right. Like, how can he plausibly commit treason? It's not going to seem like it's a jumped up, hasty plot.
Right.
Probably he's not going
with two episodes left. Yeah, you're probably right. Okay, we move on to. Oh well, it's sort of part and parcel with the whole scene here. They arrive at Dragonstone. Danny's ambushed by Euron's fleet, who are sporting ballistas on their ships. They kill Rhaegal and destroy Dany's ship, all of her ships, actually, leaving Grey Worm, Tyrion, and Varys washed up on shore. Missandei is missing, much to Grey Worm's dismay.
Yeah.
This is easily the weakest scene of this entire episode. And it's a pretty weak scene just in general, not even in this episode.
I mean, here's the thing. Like, I'm not going to belabor it, but, like, you've got eyeballs.
Yeah.
Take a back of a cocktail napkin, sketch out where these forces were the time of
conflict. The problem is a cocktail napkin is 2D.
Yeah.
You almost need to think in three dimensions here. And, like, where could Euron possibly hide that a dragon flying, 3,000 feet in the air couldn't see?
Yeah. And it's like, this is kind of like the same problem I had with, I'm just going to risk pissing off all the fan bases, but like The Last Jedi, it's like you deploy a technology and tactic that has been well established throughout the realm in history, but like literally, like, no, like, these things are fucking cannons before cannons existed.
Oh, like, and they're
like
super
a real
cannons.
Ballista can throw like something like 400 or 500 meters. This thing's throwing them like a mile or two.
And then they're flying right through the boats, like cheddar cheese, man.
And then you have these guys like with one. You have these guys picking out Rhaegal, and he goes down like with pinpoint accuracy, 3 shots, 3 hits. Mm-hmm. And then Danny charges at the middle of them. Like, this is a self-inflicted gunshot wound.
It is,
like, you don't... Yes, Danny should go crazy. Like I don't understand why Danny lives to that. Like, there's some mistakes your character
I almost
can't
felt
make
like...
Without walk... You can't, and it's just like last... This was the aerial equivalent of Brienne going down under 30 white screaming, and then,
popping up fine.
Yeah, popping up fine 5 minutes later. Like, you can't... If you're unwilling to kill the character, don't put him in a situation where a reasonable person would be like, there's no fucking way. Like, is she fucking Jules from Pulp Fiction? Was this like a according to Hoyle, miracle that I just witnessed? Because that's what it felt like.
It absolutely did. And I think, there's something that I read into this scene that maybe isn't there, but I almost felt like Danny was so pissed off about Rhaegal dying that she took Drogon in on this charge. And when Drogon saw what was about to happen... Drogon just took off,
against her.
I felt that a little bit watching.
I was watching it too. I felt like, and again, I don't know why they don't have saddles or something. So this could be like, I feel like she was pulling on his horns that she couldn't commit him. That she's like, this is my last. He's a little bit Cersei, with her last son,
or Jaime. Oh, okay,
yeah. Like she.
The whole charge thing was like Jaime all the way, right?
But there's also the other thing that's really stupid about this is. I don't like I feel like Danny could have like this was a one time thing they could have done and she could have like why not fly around attack the fleet from the rear. They only have the one ballista. It's pointed. I'm sure it can rotate, but what are they going to do? Fire through their fucking masts and their sails and
how
accurate would
see?
That be?
Yeah, they'd be
and like
blind.
she can wheel around and flank them in like 30-40 seconds and it is very obvious that no one shot this past any kind of advisor or any kind of like technical consultant. It's just like, we think it'd be cool and let's do it. And that's disappointing to me.
And these are the things that make me say this is a production that just wants to be done.
Yeah.
And is willing to shortcut things and willing to just put something on screen that gets them to where they need to be to end this fucking series. Finally.
Right.
In some scenes, I think they take care with others. Maybe the stuff that interests them more. Maybe they're not as interested in, these battles and stuff. They're more interested in the characters and the human angle.
Well, that's what I think was always brilliant about George is he very rarely gave you big battles. It was always like the battle's about to join, and then you'd skip a POV and you'd come back and it was the aftermath.
Right.
Because George sucks at writing big battles. He's pretty okay at like one-on-one action. And you think about like the really big, impressive, like it's always been like, you think of Oberyn versus the Mountain. That wasn't thousands facing against thousands. That was two men that fucking hated each other and for good reason.
Uh-huh.
And it was flashy and it was cool. Scaling that up to like tens of thousands of people is very hard to do.
Yeah, I agree.
Especially, yeah. So I kind of think that they promise spectacle. They want to deliver spectacle. They're just not great at delivering spectacle.
All right, Cersei brought the people of King's Landing inside the walls of the Red Keep, winning their favor, and she tells Euron that her baby is his. And then we see, oh, there's Missandei. She's being held in the Red Keep. So Cersei kind of consolidating and making the cost of burning King's Landing very fucking high.
No, her, like, so this is the part of the story they're telling very well. Like, even, like, the fact that they got lucky and got Missandei, and now that she's in chains and she's going to die in chains after, like... This is like great propaganda, like, oh, break your chains, you can't even save your own damn people. And it's calculated to just make Dany completely over irrational. Like, this is fucking this is really good. This is, I think, is really good. And the imagery of Missandei standing there in chains with Cersei sneering so much for the break her chains.
Mm-hmm.
Boy, you really fucking hate Cersei all over again.
Fantastic. Varys tells Dany that she's making a huge mistake by attacking King's Landing full force, killing innocent people. Tyrion suggests that they demand Cersei surrender and offer her life in exchange for the throne. Dany goes along with it in an effort to prove that Cersei's to blame for the fates of the people.
Yeah. So far, like, you know, her advisors made a reasonable request and she acquiesced to it, especially since it's 2 weeks until Jon, the rest of the army gets there. Like, this is all... sense.
But again, I mean, Dany, with this sense of entitlement, like, I'm here to free the world of tyrants. That's my destiny. Well, plus, and I will see it through at all costs. Like, that's ominous.
Plus, Grey Worm, which is the last of her original board of advisors, obviously wants to go in full bore
and
rescue Missandei or get vengeance for her. So, like, he's compromised. She's compromised. It's all of these other fake fucking Johnny-come-lately friends that are telling her to wait.
Mm-hmm.
Her lover, her cousin, her nephew lover's not around. It's like I said, this is, if they're going to tell the story, this is the way you tell it.
Kind of talked about this scene already, but they're disturbed by Dany's latest bout with anger. So Varys wants to switch sides and back Jon as king, which is treason, as Tyrion points out. Tyrion is holding fast on Dany's side, seemingly pitting them against each other.
Yeah.
I do wish there was still this whole, like, shadow level to this game to play. Yeah. The Varys is so good at, but it doesn't seem like there's really an opportunity for that.
And my sympathies are, like, I do like Varys's. He says, hey, my loyalty is to the realm. And Tyrion tries, like, oh, what is even the realm? And he's like, the realm is millions of people who deserve to live and to be able to feed their children.
Yeah.
And you don't know who they are, but they still exist and they're real. And I care about them because those are essentially my people. Like, that's righteous. That's right on.
Mm-hmm.
Like, Varys for the Iron Throne 2020.
Yeah. And it's so weird here because, like, Varys is opposing Dany, who says all those same things. Right.
Right.
It's just a matter of, does Varys believe that she actually wants the thing she's saying, or does she just want power?
Well, it's the way she phrased it, like, my destiny is to free the world of tyrants and I will serve that destiny no matter the cost. Like,
that's so,
no matter the cost. So you will become a tyrant to rid the world of tyrants, and then what, you blow your head off with a six shot revolving crossbow, no doubt. She is, like, there are no brakes to this crazy train. Like, once you decide to believe that, now she can calm down. She can she can have her advisors calm her down. But, like, once you have that worldview, it's super dangerous.
Yeah. Jaime gets the news about the loss of Dany's dragon and fleet. And later that night, he decides to leave Winterfell and return to King's Landing, leaving Brienne weeping in the courtyard.
So
super sad scene.
There's some takes I can't that say that Jaime actually is turning cloak and going back to Cersei to protect her.
Okay, so one of those takes is inside the episode with either Dan or David. I don't remember which is which.
The liars, the lying liars that tell us lies.
I wrote down what they said. They, basically, Jaime has an addiction to Cersei that he can't break. That does not feel right to me.
I hope, because that scares the fuck out of me, because I could totally see them thinking that.
But I think they're lying.
I think so, too.
I think Jaime is, in fact, going back to deal with Cersei by taking her out.
No, and I think that, like, you know, the way it's, like, it seems obvious that he is listing a litany of things he's done for Cersei, and he's over Cersei, but she, I'm hateful, like, so, like, I can't sit back and trust that this is going to, I got to do it. I feel personally responsible for this evil, and I got to take care of it. And I also want to say this in a hurtful way so that you don't get mixed up in it, because you took an oath to protect this girl. You would, I know you would probably forswear that to join me on my little campaign, and I can't have you doing that. So it's kind of like, you know, throwing the rocks at the dog that you want to go away because you're trying to save its life.
Right. He should have sent her off with Tormund.
Right.
Just like John did with Ghost.
But yeah, the double D saying that, like, he's got a Cersei addiction is like,
I don't believe him. I just don't believe them.
Yeah. But if they believe it and they make that, like, if Jaime is standing by her side and doesn't betray her and dies fighting Defender, like, I don't know what. That's really a lot losing the plot. I'd have to clear bankruptcy again.
I agree. So final scene, Dany meets Cersei at the gates of King's Landing where they trade terms. Neither side will budge. So Tyrion tries to convince his sister to surrender for the sake of her unborn child. She refuses and chops off Missandei's head, enraging Dany and all but guaranteeing there will be no peaceful resolution to this conflict.
My question is, why didn't Cersei just win here?
Propriety. Or since her sense of honor. Yeah.
Okay. So again, no, why?
Exactly. Like, I don't have a good answer for you.
They staged a scene where this should have been a decisive victory for the forces of evil.
Uh-huh.
That good willingly walked into and were stupid.
Yeah, I honestly can't tell you why.
Can I?
I love everything else about this scene.
I have
but
another
that
question.
Kind of
does Qyburn make it back to the gates of King's Landing?
I assume he did.
How? Because, like, they, like, the second they shove Missandei off the wall, like, the Unsullied should rush forward and kill.
Well, I mean,
Qyburn,
a lot of shoulds.
Right?
There are a lot of shoulds in this scene.
Yeah, I know. I
mean, None of them actually happened, yeah. And it's unfortunate.
So let's just say that, yes, the way this thing is staged and conceived is, like, and at the range we know these ballistas floating on a fucking ship have, and Drogon being a stationary target, and the queen standing right there, and
should have
been
her hand even closer.
So that's dumb. Tyrion, what the fuck is Tyrion doing trying to appeal to Cersei? And, like, saying, like, I don't, like, even if he's
this
saying
this
for her benefit.
This is why I say he's lost so much of what made him great.
Yeah, he's
is
desperate.
Because he doesn't fucking get Cersei anymore.
I feel like that's the tragedy of his story that you're trying to tell, and maybe doing a good job of this particular part, is, like, that he's just desperate.
Mm-hmm.
He doesn't want Dany to be the person that he deep down knows she is.
Yeah.
So anything he can do or say to avoid this, like, you know, and I do think he does believe that Cersei loves her children. And I think he's saying, like, look at all these badasses outside. Look at our dragon, you know, please. But I don't think Cersei thinks she's going to lose. And honestly, I found myself on second watch really agreeing with what Qyburn was saying. Like,
yeah, he's right about the
Tyrion
assessment of their armies.
Like, you gotta talk sense and he's like, what the fuck are you talking about?
Mm-hmm.
We got the defensive position. We've got this sophisticated technology. You're down to one dragon, and you got a queen that's afraid to use her. Like, I think we've got this, dude.
Mm-hmm.
So,
no, I don't think he's wrong.
Yeah,
I think if you set aside the should haves in this scene, that everything else is amazing.
Yeah.
I think, like, between especially the acting. The acting in this scene is so fucking good.
Yeah.
The acting between Peter Dinklage and Lena Headey, fantastic. The look that Tyrion gives back to Dany when Missandei's head comes off is, it's hard to describe because Peter Dinklage puts such nuance into it, but
right.
It's like a combination of, I'm sorry I let this happen.
Right.
And now, like, I'm actually scared of what you're going to do in reaction. And, like, there's just so much tied up in that one look. And then, like, Grey Worm's reaction to Missandei's head coming off. Can't even look at it. Turns around and is almost physically ill, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's so good. And then you put Ramin Djawadi's score behind that.
Right.
And it's incredible. I think this is an incredible note to leave the third to last episode on.
Right.
I just wish it made a little more sense in the framing, the setup.
Yeah, and here's the thing, like, I also think that there's evidence that some of this stuff might actually be from Martin, because at least the broad strokes, because he likes to ponder these things about, like, what happens when people are subjected to trauma and stress. And do they can they regain the, can they keep their heroic qualities and nobility? There was something I was in researching this book I wrote. There's this figure that's like an offhanded thing that's mentioned in the books as Bacchalon, the pale child that's worshipped as a god of death in the Temple of Black and White. And it was Martin paying homage to this science fiction series he wrote, This Thousand Worlds, like big universe that he was building before Game of Thrones. And one of the factions is Earth, and humanity was traumatized by this outside race of aliens that came to kind of brutalize and invade them, and they narrowly won a victory. But it completely changed Earth's culture. So like this, they got this god called Bacchalon, which is an inversion of the Christ myth. Like instead of the baby, innocent baby Jesus born in a manger, this is a baby with a flaming sword, and he calls his followers the wolves, my wolves, instead of Jesus was the good shepherd, and they preach this like xenophobic war, like we never again will this happen to us, we're going to conquer everyone regardless of how they feel about us, we're just going to like this, we just become this rage society. And I
the
feel
tyrant
like
killer becoming the tyrant,
like a Missandei. Like I thought when I first watched, I'm like, her shouting Dracarys, she has to know what that would do.
Yes, she does.
But she does, because she's now been enslaved again by these fuckers.
Yeah.
Like, would she, like, and like, you know, if my queen who wants to free the world has to fight with this queen who wants to enslave it, and these people back her, then fuck these people. And I do think there is something to this, like, all these people have been so traumatized, like Sansa, like, she doesn't ever want the North to kneel again. You know, Arya, she's been so broken and perverted through all the experiences she's had that she can't even envision a healthy and happy home life with people that she loves. Like Dany, who has gone through all this to end tyranny, sliding into tyranny herself to make like this all fucking is really heady and attracts. And it's like of a piece of the things that Martin is trying to do. It's just, I guess, surprising that it's this kind of bleak. When I heard Bittersweet, I wasn't thinking like Dany and Jon would fight a civil war over the corpse of Cersei. Like, I'm actually wondering how they're going to inject some sweetness into this.
Yeah, that's fair.
But none of this...
Because the indication, I mean, Emilia Clarke, I think, does an excellent job at the end of this episode displaying in a very subtle way, but also a very powerful way, exactly what Dany is thinking.
Yeah, like, I think...
not end peacefully.
The more and more, the thing I think they realize that, like, it's not so much a storytelling is terrible. I do think that, like we said, the way they frame some of the stuff, some of the sets that they choose, some of the way they stage it is bad, but like we're more disappointed that our heroes are falling into like vice and despair and grief and rage than we are like, oh, this is just, you know, just roundly the idea that Dany would become a mad queen is bad. I don't know, that's kind of my take.
Yeah, I don't think Look, I don't know that there is a storyline well told that is a bad, inherently bad storyline. I think it can make the fans it can make the fans feel bad, and it can make the fans upset and angry. Yeah. And honestly, you should be upset and angry. If you are a fan of Dany, which I consider myself for seasons now, this should upset you.
Mm-hmm.
You don't want Dany to give in to her her darker side. Mm-hmm. And you know, this story, that's part of the bittersweet, right? Yeah. Like, Dany may win the throne, but what does she have to do to get there?
Yeah.
And who will she become if she does it?
Yeah, no, like, this is like a... imagine if Star Wars were told in a chronological order. So, like, the first trilogy happened. So, this is Anakin joining the Emperor, right? It's not Luke Skywalker throwing the lightsaber aside and choosing love and peace over, you know, conquest and hate and anger and all that. But this is, like... You know, I think we're expecting Luke Skywalker, and we're getting Anakin.
Yeah, unfortunately, we won't maybe get the original trilogy of this story.
And I also say, like, I use that advisedly because, like, that's a perfectly fine story to tell. Everyone is, but like, I think George Lucas did a kind of a shitty job of telling that story.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
And I think in the last couple seasons, the Double D's have, bereft of the original source material that's excellent, have struggled to tell this story and come to a satisfying conclusion. Now, the other thing I keep asking myself is like, well, if they tell a valid story that pisses everyone off, is that successful? Is that a successful story?
I think a story like that can only be successful in hindsight.
Yeah.
I think it will have a visceral negative reaction from the fandom.
Right.
And then maybe in 5 years, people will come back and say, you know, I was really pissed off, but actually this makes a lot of sense and it was really well told. Now, I don't know if they'll get there.
I feel like that's like you can draw comparisons to like Sopranos.
Yes.
That like that was a very divisive ending at first. But like I think
that was an artistic choice, which I think is a little different than
But I think that 50-50 people were like, this is horseshit. And I think now if you ask fans the Sopranos, it's probably 90-10 like it versus because they've thought about it, they come to grips with it, they realize their TV's not malfunctioning. Lost is kind of similar. Like there's like a 50-50 split, I think, in the fandom that if I've taken the temperature lately, I feel like more like probably 75% of people say, you know what, I never expected this to go this way, but it would be interesting to see a very divisive, finale that people hate, but then they start thinking about it and people start writing about it and there's podcasts about it. And a year or two from now, people are like, this is actually better than John and Danny sitting on the Iron Throne bouncing baby Drogo or whatever on their knee and living happily ever after.
No, this is the way of everything I feel on the internet. Mm-hmm. Everything that was bad 5 years ago is now good, and everything that was good 5 years ago is now bad. Like people re-examine their opinions and they think, why did I feel that way? Why did I feel this other way? And it feels like there are multiple stages to the reaction. One is immediate. The next is sort of like the backlash to the immediate, right? Like the people who hate it will come out and say, oh, fuck this, I hated it. People who love it will combat them. And then, 5 years, whatever from now, we'll start to narrow in on the general feeling and how it's going to be remembered.
Yeah. I mean, like there's like, defenders of the Star Wars prequels now, like unironic defenders, and think it's great, and it's not. And so there's always a stage in a fandom where like something happens and like there is a level of denial between people like that love what's going on and they're overlooking the flaws, and the people that can't see what the good that's going on because all they can look at is the flaws. Because like right now, like I think there are like, I think there's objectively things wrong with the way they staged the death of Rhaegal and the way they staged this show off, but or the showdown between Dany and Cersei. And if you love the show, you have to love it despite knowing that there are flaws and that like, okay, I'm going to be fine with these flaws. But right now we're in a stage where we're just arguing whether flaws are flaws. Yeah. And we can't get to like,
we're too close to it.
Yeah. It's like, that's not a wart. That's a beauty mark. Fuck you. It's a wart. Like, okay, let's fucking biopsy this fucker. Figure out if it's a wart or beauty mark. Then it's like, once it's like, oh, it's a wart. It's like, well, I still think she's pretty. Fine. But don't try to tell me it's a beauty mark. So we'll see how this all sorts out. And who knows what the next 2 weeks will bring.
Yeah.
We're about 10 weeks out from House of the Dragon Season 2, and it's time to prepare for war.
Which in our case means, watching a lot of Hot D and reading a lot of Fire and Blood.
Each week between now and June 16th, Maester Anthony and his co-host Steve are hosting a watch of each episode of Hot D Season 1. And then me and Jim are going to host a discussion of the differences between the events on that episode and how they're recounted in George R.R. Martin's historical tome, Fire and Blood.
That's right, I've resorted to reading dragon books. God help us all. We'll see if my fresh eyes add any new insights or predictions into Season 2.
Arm yourselves with all the lore you can for the battles ahead. House of the Dragon returns June 16th, but we've got you covered until then.
Check out all of our upcoming Hot D coverage on the Hot D feed or on Bald Move Pulp, available wherever you listen to podcasts. FX is adapting James Clavell's best-selling novel, Shogun, into a 10-part miniseries this spring. Set in the shogunate period of Japan at the turn of the 15th century, Shogun depicts the rise of a feudal lord to Shogun, as seen through the eyes of a shipwrecked English sailor. It's loosely based on the real-life exploits of William Adams and Tokugawa Ieyasu.
Shogun has already been successfully adapted back in 1980 with a widely acclaimed miniseries starring Richard Chamberlain. Featuring intricate plots, political scheming, complex characters, and thrilling action. This time, husband and wife team Justin Marks and Rachel Kondo try to recapture the successes of the novel and early adaptations, while increasing the levels of historical and cultural accuracy that are often perceived as flaws of this and similar works.
starring Hiroyuki Sanada from The Last Samurai, Mortal Kombat, and John Wick 4, with Cosmo Jarvis of Peaky Blinders, Raised by Wolves, etc., joining the truly massive cast required to bring this complex world to life. Join Aaron and I each week as we deep dive into each episode, uncovering the mysteries, the intrigue, and the glory of Shogun.
Shogun premieres on FX Hulu Tuesday, February 27th, with a two-part debut. Our podcast will release each Thursday thereafter. Get our Shogun coverage by searching for Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app. Hey, it's time for another season of Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? The premise is simple. A Gen Xer and a millennial watch old 80s action TV to see what still works and what doesn't. In previous seasons, we've done podcasts for Knight Rider, Airwolf, MacGyver, A-Team, and more. However, this year we're doing a very special season of Feeny. We're going back and reviewing the very special episodes of 80s and 90s sitcoms. Come cringe along with us as Hollywood tries to warn our families of the dangers of underage smoking, drug abuse, alcoholism, eating disorders, and much more. We start out with the episode of Boy Meets World where a high school kid gets sucked into a cult. Worlds collide as the Mr. Feeny finally makes an appearance on Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? Join me and my buddy Jay each week for episodes full of nostalgia and secondhand embarrassment. And don't worry, if Very Special isn't your speed, we've also got some all-time classic Knight Rider episodes to close the season with. Find Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? Each Wednesday on Bald Move Pulp, starting April 3rd.
So we thought it'd be fun to give our audience a behind-the-scenes look at how we book ads on Bald Move. So we're going to let you listen in live to a phone conference with our ad agency.
Are you drunk?
What? No, we're professionals. It's like noon here. Okay, maybe we're drunk a little bit. Look, we're getting off on the wrong foot here. We wanted to chat about your concerns with our club's ad-free feeds.
I wish you'd never told me. If I didn't know, I'd be happy right now.
Oh, we don't want to upset you.
It doesn't matter what you want. What happens when they demand you press your claim and take what is mine?
Pressing claim? What are you talking about? Look, you're our ad partner. We want to sell ads. We just want to tell our club members how they can avoid them.
You can say nothing to anyone ever, or it will take on a life of its own and you won't be able to control it or what it does to people.
What? They can skip ads, gain access to bonus content, and VIP sections of forums. I really don't see any runaway potential here.
I want it to be the way it was between us.
Oh, look, we also have a relationship with our audience, you know? We can't hide club features from them. They deserve the truth.
Even if the truth destroys us.
It won't.
It will. I've never begged for anything. But I'm begging you. Don't do this.
You're our ad partner. Nothing will change that. Our listeners are our family. We can live together.
We can. I've just told you how.
Did they just hang up on us?
Yeah, I guess they really feel strongly about this. But you know what? Our audience is family. We think you should know that signing up at club.baldmove.com is a great way to get bonus audio and video content, watch live recordings of the podcast, get VIP access to forums, and yes, listen to our podcast ad-free. You can preview everything at club.baldmove.com. Check it out to find out what the ad companies don't want you to know. Shall we do feedback?
Let's do it.
Game of Thrones at baldmove.com is where you want to send feedback for us. You also know we have forums, forums.baldmove.com. First up, Kelly M. After a long night, I read a lot of takes on Bran, griping about how useless he was in a fight against the Night King. But I think this episode, there is a moment that helps explain Bran's role more clearly. When Jon is with Arya and Sansa asking them to swear to keep the secret of his heritage, and he looks to Bran and Bran replied, "It's your choice," it reinforced the idea that Bran is simply an observer, seeing multiple paths at once, but what shapes and decides what happens is people's choices. Bran cannot interfere in the affairs of men to try to force an outcome. Of course, he could sway people's decisions, like, for example,
really
Jon.
Really fucked over Hodor.
Like
to influence the outcome of that event.
He could sway Jon's decision by saying, if you do this, things won't turn out well, but that could in turn force a worse outcome, and Bran would be responsible for that. We see that the path Jon's decision leads to for the Seven Kingdoms, but as my Bran guy says, no regrets because everything you did brought you to where you are now, home. which is where you need to be.
I mean, I'm struggling to understand what exactly Bran can do and can see, and how much influence he can have over future events. Like, I don't think he sees future events. And I understand that sometimes he can interfere in situations, like the Hodor one, for instance, and I know that's a thing, but like, what can he actually, can he maneuver pieces at all in an effort to get to some end goal if he can't see it? I don't think there's
a successful story to be told there with him learning a lesson from Hodor. Like, I commandeered Hodor to save my skin. It actually completely fucked up Hodor's life. It didn't, like, really affect the outcome much. Like, I learned a lesson as a three-eyed raven that you can't take direct control.
Mm-hmm.
You got to, like, influence, and you can manipulate, and you can hint. But if the second you try to say, this is what needs to happen, it's just going to fuck things up. I don't think they're doing a good job of telling that story, though. And also, like, I think it's a fair question to wonder what the fuck Bran was doing when he was warging the entire episode.
Yeah.
Like, if he had just, like, been with Theon and just patiently waiting for the Night King, not warging, then I would buy the whole, oh, well, he was just, he did his job, and now he's just waiting to see how fate and destiny works out. But he was actively doing something. And if he wasn't just watching, like, the wide, wide world of sports as a way to pass time, like, essentially browsing, like, his phone in the line of the bank or whatever, then what the hell was he doing? I think that's a fair question to ask. And I hope, that's one of my few remaining hopes after declaring bankruptcy, is I do hope that we get a satisfying answer to that.
I mean, I think we've got a partial answer, which one that I don't necessarily think was super satisfying is that he's the memory of the realm.
But how was that being used in that moment?
Yeah, what purpose did, you know, warging into all these birds serve in that effort? I don't know.
I think what we'll see is him do that one more time, and now we'll actually see exactly what he's doing. And, like, we joked about, like, the whole, like, you didn't do a damn thing, Bran. Oh, didn't I?
Mm-hmm.
It would be interesting to show, like, through that lens, ways that he might have subtly influenced the other battle.
Yeah.
Without actually telling it, because otherwise it's just like, you know, you're the three-eyed raven. What the fuck? You helped your sisters kill Littlefinger, maybe.
The email is an effort to explain it, to figure it out. But I also think it doesn't quite fit because Hodor.
And also some of the facts are unexplainable. Like, we have a fact that he warged the entire time of the Battle of Winterfell. But what was he doing? We know that he got a close up look at the Night King, but why would he do that? Like, you know, was it just curious? Like, he's just morbidly curious about how close the Night King was to killing him. And then once he is in the courtyard, it's like, oh, I can actually use my real eyes. That's not a very satisfying answer, but it would be an answer.
Sure.
All right. Lauren M. Varys has been sidelined for most of season 7 and 8. So I'm excited to finally see him stirring some shit. What do you think Varys is about to do about Dany? We know that he has destroyed kings and families with his little birds, and maybe he tries to convince Jon to take the throne. I don't see him completely jumping ship and using his fins to swim all the way over to Jon's side, but I see him using the information he has about Jon to convince other people to join his cause.
Here's the problem with trying to convince Jon.
Yeah.
If he fails, he's dead.
Right.
Like, that's no longer shadow treason. That's fucking treason.
It's actual treason.
To a queen loyalist's face, you're going to die, and Jon will execute you.
And the other problem, like we outlined in the episode, is, like, who could he meet with that needs no introduction?
Yeah.
You know.
I'm at a loss as to what Varys does next.
Right.
And actually, I'm kind of excited that I am at a loss, because if I want to give the Double D's some credit, they might have something in store for me that I'm not seeing coming that could be great.
Yeah. There'll be a whole army of bronze with crossbows to come out behind the cliff to shoot him as he's about to commit treason.
I put the qualifier could be great on that. Come on.
Ryan C. I want to write in on the turn of Dany towards the Mad Queen. To begin, she's always been anti-authority to those who abuse their power for the most part and pretty benevolent to those below her. I think this inherently this quality would make her a good queen. It's probably why she fell for Jon so hard, because in a lot of ways he's the same. Dany has faced many betrayals of her trust, and perhaps enough is enough, though. She trusted her brother to protect her, and he sold her off into slavery, and she let him be killed. Miri Maz Duhr, who she freed from captivity and saved from rape, betrays her and kills Drogo, and she burns her alive. Jorah betrays her and banishes him forever.
She conquers Marine. Okay, so he goes off a litany that we all know of her greatest, you know, moments of all the different betrayals. Like with Cersei saying, "Hey, I'm your ally." No, I'm not. And then Jon, you know, giving her the North, but the North all hates her. So he says that this whole lead up only makes sense if she eventually snaps. And losing Jorah, Missandei, and her dragons in 2 days would set anybody off.
I do feel like it could also pay off if she comes very close to snapping, and we're afraid she'll snap.
Yeah.
I don't think she necessarily has to, but I see your point, yeah.
Right. And also, there's a lot of some problematic snapping here. Like, Miriam Azdur, she's, like, and I feel like people don't get the Miriam Azdur character. That, she didn't betray Dany, because Dany was never her ally. Dany, because she felt bad about all these women getting raped, decided to arbitrarily save a few for herself. From Miriam Azdur's perspective, you fucked me. You fucked my town. You burnt that. You pulled down my god's altars. You burnt them. You savaged all. You killed every one of the male children in my town. Oh, you saved me from rape after I probably already been passed around by two or three writers. Fuck you. And this is what I did. And now you can feel what it feels like to be me. And everybody's like, fucking Miriam Azdur betraying Dany like that. Like, there, you know, it's like something that was like one, I think, Dany's first lessons at how you can, you know, like it's not so easy to just come in and be like, oh, I'm going to be the savior, you know?
Yeah.
And like, this is, you know, if you ask any person in King's Landing, their opinion on Dany burning them alive to save them, pretty sure it would turn out negative.
Yeah.
So anyway, Tara, moving on. Tara L. It's not in Dany's nature to slaughter thousands of innocent people, but I think that's the whole reason they killed Rhaegal and Missandei. Rhaegal could have easily died last episode, but it's more of a gut punch for Dany to have him die at the hands of her enemy and rival rather than the undead. As an English teacher and lover of literature, I always favor the books over the show, but I understand your frustration with the show deviating from the spirit of the books. I think there are aspects of the latest episode that, while hardly Shakespeare, were nonetheless Shakespearean in their intrigue. The secrets, the backstabbing, Dany is Macbeth and Lady Macbeth, all wrapped up in the one. And by the way, prophecies never help Shakespeare's characters. What I mean to say by that is that I still have hope. I mean, yeah, Macbeth is interesting because, like, imagine the set piece of Macbeth where the forest comes alive and marches on the castle, like, being staged. Because, like, the description is literally, like, the opposing army is holding, like, big branches in front of their faces. The camouflage themselves as trees. Uh-huh. And if you actually saw that happen on a screen, like, lovingly created, it would look ridiculous, right? The double Ds just have the problem that, like, they can't just have, you know, Macbeth looking out and being like, oh my god, look at the fulfillment of the prophecy, I'm under, you know, they have to actually put this on a screen, and a lot of times they do it, and you can just tell it's dudes holding branches in front of their face.
Gotcha.
So,
yeah.
Katie, this show has recently been setting up Dany to be the Mad Queen, especially with the killing of Missandei to push her to the breaking point, but I will personally be very disappointed and angry if the show takes this route.
You and many other people.
Dany has been such a triumphant figure and a symbol of hope for women in a world where men seemingly always have the upper hand. Cersei has lamented about what she would have been able to accomplish if only she were a man. Well, Dany has accomplished a ton and has a very impressive resume. She's put faith in herself, which led to many others devoting themselves to her. She's always found a unique way to deal with her obstacles, such as when she was acquiring the Unsullied. She has provided the show with many badass moments that left me too pumped to even be able to fall asleep on several nights. I just hope they don't end her arc with a crazed spiral because her dad went mad, and it's an easy way to pick between her and Jon. Just want to know your thoughts about whether you think there's an interesting way she could be both the Mad Queen, because that seems like a path the show is taking, and still remain a strong female hero.
What if you go full Mad Queen, I don't think you're a hero anymore.
Well,
is the problem.
Okay, what about Brad? Brad the Impaler. Totally different dude. Vlad the Impaler.
Okay.
You know, guy behind the Legend of Dracula.
I'm not super familiar with the lore here.
So he's essentially the real-life inspiration for Dracula.
Uh-huh.
He was this guy who was ruthless, and he made shows of impaling, like creating corpses of forest of corpses around his castle, where he would take the people that were his enemies and impale them. But he's hailed as a hero in Romania, because he, like, was a strong bulwark against these outward invaders. So The path forward for Dany to be considered a strong hero is for her to be a hero for her people and her people only.
Sounds like the Romanians are xenophobic.
Oh, I mean, the outside forces actually were coming to kill them. So.
Oh, okay. Well, yeah. Maybe warranted.
Who wouldn't worship Bacchalon, the pale child, in those circumstances? But so it's like, that's the thing. It's like everyone else thinks he's a giant asshole and cruel and inhuman. And but like, to the people that he protected. So like, Dany can still be the hero to the Dothraki, to the Unsullied, to the people
I
that
think she is already that.
The people she saves, but the people that like
all the slaves and Slaver's Bay, like
the other people that are on the other end will be annihilated, and they won't be. So like, now is that a hero you want to root for? But that's a way that she could still be heroic, a heroic figure.
Yeah, I have trouble with, I guess, hypocritical heroes.
Yeah,
if I had to come up with a term for them, someone who becomes the thing they hate in order to vanquish the thing they hate, that that never sits well with me. And I'm not certain that Dany is going to go that way, but I am certain they are pushing her that direction.
Right.
I'm with you. I hope she does not make this decision. Cool. I don't want to see her become the villain.
Yeah.
And I,
even from a certain point of view, if she's still the hero,
still feels wrong to me.
Yeah. Alexis A. It seems that every decision that led to a true act of heroism from Dany has happened when she acted alone without counsel. Tyrion and Varys are dead set against checking her worst impulses, quote-unquote, but since the beginning of the series, we've seen her use these impulses with ample success. She stepped into the Great Fire and birthed her dragons. She calmed the masters of Astapor and gained the loyalty of the Unsullied. She set aflame the Dothraki sacred temple and proved her strength to the full Khalasar. And, you know, Alexis is right. The whole time, her advisors were like, Dany, no! Don't throw yourself on that pyre! Dany, no! Don't try to get the slave army! Dany! So, like, yeah. I see what you're saying here. With Tyrion,
I feel like her righteous compass is right on track.
Mm-hmm.
But there are some things around the edges that, you know, hinder her.
Not all means justify all ends.
Yes.
With Tyrion's incompetence and Varys turncloaking at the forefront of the final season, it's now or never for Dany to be a dragon. Maybe Missandei's Dracarys was not a suggestion to burn everything down, but rather a reminder for Dany to be true to herself.
Mm.
With her army depleted, core allies dead, and last dragon vulnerable, I hope we see Dany manifest her fire and blood for intelligently conniving and strategic use one last time. Conniving.
Might be in for a disappointment.
Yeah.
I think, like, all bets are off next episode. I don't know what path Dany is going to go down, but she is very angry right now.
Right. It's kind of like if she'd attacked the Maesters of Astapor or Masters of Astapor and killed them and all the slaves, except for the Unsullied, we'd feel about that a lot differently. And that's that's the point. She can't just decap. There is no, like, Cersei's not like the Masters that she can just, you know, well, I mean, I don't know. That's because that's a valid way for the show to go, too. Like, for, you know, Dany to drop propaganda leaflets from her dragon saying, hey, we're not doing this for you. We're trying to free you from Cersei. We know Cersei's this and that. And there's a lot of things that could work. We've seen them work. I mean, that's the reason the Faith Militant came about, is because all that shit that Stannis stirred about her, you know, the king sitting on a throne being an abomination and a product of incest, and all that shit worked. So, but she's going to Dracarys her way out of this, it seems like. Derek W. I have grown increasingly frustrated with Tyrion's thought patterns. I don't understand why he sees Cersei as this rational human being. Mm-hmm. What made him think that bringing up her unborn child would somehow humanize her into a surrender? Why would you think you could show up at Dragonstone and not get ambushed?
You're right. Keep going. Sorry.
he just concludes, Tyrion at this point has not given Dany any advantages since becoming Hand of the Queen. He's a hindrance at this point. I forgot to mention this in the outline, but I will add one point. What do you think of the theory, or have you seen the theory, that the whole reason Tyrion went up to confer with Cersei is to drop the fact that he knew about Cersei's pregnancy before he should have been able to? So that clues Euron in the fact that he's been hoodwinked.
Man, I don't think Euron's that smart. Well, like, if you're trying to subtly tip off this imbecile,
right.
No, it ain't going
to
work.
And it is a way to tell that story, and the story is to cut to, as Tyrion's talking, a skeptical-looking Euron going, like, wait a minute. Yep. But while there were some shots of him doing that, they were not in response to this thing.
No.
So I feel like they're not telling that. Because the other thing is, like, I don't think Euron would give a shit either. Like, all that matters is that people think the child is his.
Mm-hmm.
So even if it's Jaime, if he wins this war and Cersei sits on Iron Throne and she, like, I it's not only that I think he's stupid, I also think he just wouldn't give a shit.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I don't think that would offend him. So it's not like he got, you know, Cersei as an unblemished virgin queen.
Sure.
So
sure.
He knows about Jaime, he knows about Robert. Like, all, like it, I, why would he care? So, I thought that was a little reach, too.
Yeah.
That'd be brilliant, though, if, like, that's what, you know, like he's playing Cersei instead of being played. But I just don't think they had that in mind shooting that scene.
But I'll agree with the emailer, and I'll add on Tyrion is extra dumb because he's had this, you know, Cersei's love for her children card played against him already. Like, very recently. He should be well aware that Cersei used this against him.
But maybe
to trick him into thinking, oh, she's going to send her armies up.
All right, devil's advocate. Out. Doesn't that make that card stronger? Because Cersei played that card to keep herself safe. We went up north. We kicked these guys' ass without your help. And now we've got dead even odds of winning. And if we win, we are going. This queen, I barely got her on her Mad Queen leash now. You fucking make her go fire and blood, and there's going to be no escape for anyone. Like, this is it. Like, everything I said before is now, like, all you thought that this was going to happen. You thought that was going to happen. Well, it's not. We're outside already. Kick your ass in.
But they don't believe that they can kick their ass in.
Yeah, it's
like Qyburn's, you know, assessment is
last
right
time
on.
I tried to advocate for the devil. He's an asshole.
Yeah.
If the devil wants me as his client, he needs to stop being the devil first. All right. Becky M. I like this email a lot. Have we been paying enough attention to Sansa? The argument about attacking King's Landing the last two seasons has been about not hurting people. The only person we've actually watched actually caring about people is Sansa. In both of the last two seasons, she's concerned herself with making sure people are fed and cared for, while both Jon and Dany has been focused on dealing with the monarchical threats, the Night's King and Cersei. Though Jon is also a man of the people, he has not thought through all the ways that Sansa has. We were reminded this in last episode that when the Hound called her a little bird. Although that was the reunion I was waiting for as a fan, I was also reminded of Littlefinger, who had a bird sigil, from whom she learned so much. She also won the Hound over by touching his hand, too.
She's Big Bird now? Is that what we're saying?
He has not known that kind of contact before, and she knows it. She also seemed to intentionally antagonize Jaime about Cersei's impending death, almost to encourage him to leave Winterfell despite her appreciation for Brienne's loyalty and happiness. She also placed doubt in the heart of Tyrion with the news of Jon/Aegon, which she knew would travel beyond him. Sansa is playing the game and better than anyone.
Hell yeah, she is. And she's making no bones about it either.
Yeah.
And I think, look, Sansa definitely does care about people. And the fact that she's worried about how are we going to feed all these troops, like that kind of thing. Some of it is serving, you know, her purpose of like, and just, you know, I'm making decisions here. I'm the Lady of Winterfell, that kind of stuff.
Right.
But also, I think she genuinely does care. However,
and she was doing that before Dany rolled up with her much larger army. She was like busying about Winterfell, making sure their arms were in armor and their food was,
I will say, though, she has been in a position of luxury in regard to that because Jon has been out trying to save all of humanity. Like, I think John leaves her in charge knowing that she does care about the people and she will figure out how to keep these people safe from, you know, the sort of mortal threats that they face while he's off trying to conquer the immortal threat they face.
Sure.
So they're working together and I think they both care greatly. They're both honorable and good people. But I think Sansa plays the game way better than John.
Plus, I think John, he sees himself as guarding the realms of Meh. And Sansa just like I think she doesn't give a shit about anything other than the North and the Northern people.
Oh yeah,
like so, like her being the people's champion only extends to the neck, whereas Jon sees all of humanity as something that needs to be saved and protected. I think that's a distinction too. Caitlin T has a nice email that chains with the other one about us overlooking Sansa. During this dinner scene at Winterfell, we saw lots of reaction shots from Sansa. After Gendry, Dany said to Tyrion that you're not the only one who's clever, but Sansa's face to me said that she knew exactly what Dany was doing and she was back to playing the game. After that, she got up and started playing games of her own.
We later see some women approach the male fighters, particularly Tormund and the Hound. When the Hound turns them down, Sansa comes to check on him. They have a conversation about how without Baelish and Ramsay, she would have remained a little bird forever. This got me thinking about all the things she learned from her mentors. Do you think Sansa has her own women to sleep with men and spy for her the way Peter Baelish did? The way they started pairing off seems normal enough for after a battle like this, but the way it happened seemed more like a response to Dany's actions, like she wanted to get an idea of where men stood and if they were loyal to Dany or to Jon. Did either of you get that same take?
I hadn't thought about it, but it's interesting.
No, and I think there's a very small percent. I mean, you're talking like someone who hasn't declared bankruptcy, Caitlin. You're running to a payday lender and you're ready to rack up debt again. This is a really cool take. Like, yeah. if Sansa was running a Littlefinger scheme to, like, you know, Varys had his little birds, Littlefinger cornered all the whores in King's Landing. So, yeah, I don't think that's a story they're telling, but it would be an interesting one to tell.
Is Winterfell in danger of becoming Moletown? Is that
Moletown South, is what they call it.
Yeah.
New Moletown.
It could, under Sansa's rule, if she just has all her birds out there.
Yeah.
All the time.
Yeah. They're flitting to and fro. Nola P. As a Jaime and Brienne shipper, I was so let down by how the romantic relationship played in the show. First, they hook up drunk. Then we never get to see them happy together. And finally, after taking a virginity, Jaime just dips out on Brienne in the middle of the night.
Yeah.
After years of delicate buildup, they rushed and then crushed this relationship in a single episode. Something is wrong when the scene of Jaime knighting Brienne is more romantic than the scene of them sleeping together. Okay. I mean, I think it's entirely on point for their characters for that scene to be more romantic. Like, especially for Brienne, you know, like being knighted is a, like, sure, her arc, yeah. character arc wasn't getting fucked. She wasn't like, yeah. gotta get some D up in this P. Like, she wanted to be a knight and she got to be a knight. So that was more meaningful. This was like more of a fan service type moment, but it's, I don't know whether you're thinking, Nola, that Jaime did this on purpose or he did this like thoughtlessly or did this out of loyalty to Cersei. I think this actually was a final act of love that, like, he wants Brienne to maintain her oath to the Starks and not follow him on some damn foolish crusade. And he's going down to deal with Cersei because he feels personally responsible for it. And he doesn't think that he can, because otherwise he's just going to sit here and Winterfell and be happy with Brienne and let other people fight his battles for him.
Yeah, but I think the assessment of, like, looking at it from Brienne's side, this is exactly what
terrible.
Happened. He pumped and dumped her. Like, this...
Oh, my God, yes.
Yeah. I think that assessment is right on from Brienne's side.
Like, we didn't talk enough about this, but, like, Gwendolyn Christie, like, just playing her bereft of, like, just really shattered and begging Jaime not... Like, yeah. she's, like, saying, like, look, I know what you're doing. I understand this, but, like, just please don't do this. You don't have to do this. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's terrible.
And both her, like... there are moments of joy and there are moments of despair in this scene, and Gwendolyn Christie does an amazing job conveying both.
And it's romantic in, like, the Anne of Green Gables kind of way. Like,
it is.
It's like the heightened emotion is for real. Like, this is, like, it's romantic in the way that, like, Romeo and Juliet's romantic, right?
Like a Pride and Prejudice, sure.
Yeah, these star-crossed lovers doomed to fail. Mackenzie W., Even after accepting fan bankruptcy, I'm having a hard time reconciling what's left. Like, now, how does anyone ever believe in intel and recon? If Bran can see Littlefinger's conversation with Ned and the Lyanna Rhaegar wedding, then he can for sure see what's going on in King's Landing, right? So why not ask if he can see what Cersei is planning, like her new scorpion factory? Can't Bran warg into a raven and see Euron waiting for them? Did no one think to ask about dragon inventions of the past, like saddles or armor? Can we not see the wildfire under King's Landing? I mean, they have the greatest intel officer in the history of the world, and no one asks him any questions?
Look, Bran doesn't want to spy. Bran doesn't
want
anything.
He doesn't want anything anymore.
Yeah.
He doesn't want anyone to win or lose, or it's just like, whatever, man.
He doesn't
want
to help. He doesn't want to hurt.
He's going to live in the past.
No, that's fair. That's totally fair criticism. They do have a incredibly powerful tool that they're just not using. Or just, like, it would be fine if somebody went up and asked him to help and he said no because, like, well, I'm the three-eyed raven and I'm just a memory and, like, I can't influence the realms of men. That kind of shit.
Yeah.
It would be better if they did that than just completely ignore it.
And I got excited when I saw Tyrion go up and say, like, have a conversation with Bran. I thought that would pay off, but I think that's just literally... Like you're supposed to understand that Tyrion is essentially checking out an interesting book from the library, and he's going to read it, and then that's it.
Yeah, Bran told him, like, oh, I went to Graster's Keep, and then we went north right. into the cave. I met Three-Eyed Raven. Just telling him, like, the factual stuff about his story.
Right.
It
does seem like a failure of imagination to have Bran be this, you know, he's omniscient as far as what's happened in the past.
Mm-hmm.
Including, like, you know, I guess up to the current.
He still has not ambulated himself since season one.
Mm-hmm. And again, like, all this criticism about, like, why can't he send a pack of ravens? Why can't he be warged into the rats? Like, I don't have any great answers because I don't think there are any. So, Frank J. says, this week's episode, I was struck by how prominent the scene of Dany legitimizing Gendry was. At first glance, I buy Dany's rationale, reward for a loyal soldier, and score some points with the assembled northerners by elevating a lowborn bastard. But, as an unintended consequence of Gendry's legitimization, gives him a legal, though tenuous, claim to the throne, at least among the small folk and maesters. By Ned's admission, similar parameters were set on Robert's own claim, as the Baratheons were distant relations or relatives of the Targaryens, to smooth things over with people who were concerned with that sort of thing. Gendry, like Robert, wants one Stark woman to be his wife. Ned tells Arya at one point how much she looks like Lyanna, but for the good of the realm takes another. Sansa's already very Cersei-esque, so slots into that role nicely. There's probably a few more parallels out there, too, that I'm not thinking of, but what do you guys think of King Gendry of Fleabottom?
I think his claim is pretty dubious.
It's weaker than the both active claimants right now.
Yeah.
But I don't know. Like, is this show... if John refuses to do something about it, and Danny won't step aside, would someone like Varys try to blow smoke up Gendry's ass to fill his head full of, look how far you could rise, young Gendry? I don't buy it.
Nah.
Yeah, I don't.
Nah, I'm with you.
There's only two. There's also just like two. There's only two episodes left. So yeah, and also like him, like, yeah, like there's no way he's gonna roll right to Sansa, and why would Sansa do that?
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, no, I don't think so. I will say that like a lot of fans were, Gendry called himself Gendry Rivers, which is wrong. Like if he was born in King's Landing, he should be Gendry Waters. Also, a lot of fans were upset that there was a Starbucks coffee cup on the table in front of Sansa,
in front of
Dany at the feast. I mean, the Waters Rivers is just a fuck up. I don't know why. Like, they don't usually fuck up in-universe details that bad. This might be just another case of no one giving a fuck. But the coffee cup, people are using this as, like, essentially building a case that, like, the double Ds don't care anymore. I think production errors
happen.
Happen, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I'm inclined to let that slide. I do think that I'm feeling, like, a lessened sense of importance about sticking this landing from the mm-hmm. double D's.
Mm-hmm.
I just think they've made some sloppy decisions in you know, the staging and whatnot of certain things, the telling right. of certain stories. So I feel, you know, the naysayers on that regard, but I don't think the coffee cup is indicative of that.
Yeah. No, I mean, I think it's indicative of the fact that they're always running short of time and money and, you know, like maybe in a season that had less CGI, they'd have time to catch that and paint it out digitally. I don't know. But yeah, that stuff just happens all the time. I think there's been a season that there was like a Jeep that was in the background of a shot. And even in the fucking like Fellowship of the Ring, I think there's a scene where like Sam and Frodo are leaving a Shire where there's like a truck with exhaust going in the background.
Clearly, like, Peter Jackson doesn't give a shit about Lord of the Rings.
Right,
then.
I'm saying some shit just gets.
Yeah.
You nothing's perfect because you always run out of time and money eventually, and it has to be shipped. So,
mm-hmm.
I'm less inclined to give double D's the benefit of the doubt, but I think there's your nitpicking
for sure.
If the Starbucks coffee cup is what sent you flying into the, you're already on your way to flying. Jennifer B., so angry by the treatment and betrayal of Ghost as a result of the betrayal of John's character, I just had to vent. Let me start with the caveat, thank you, that I completely understand and agree that the show has to demonstrate the progression from Stark Snow to Targaryens and its relationship he has with the physical manifestations of the House Sigil. The wolf/dragon could have been poetic. However, come on, not even a boop on the nose. Never mind a heartfelt thank you for your loyalty, Ghost. I'm sorry I didn't deserve it. I'm actually questioning John as a character if he can so easily dismiss this duress link to the Starks. If it was just a result of a poor production choice based on budget, shame, shame, shame. I mean,
yeah. No, it's pretty indefensible. Other than, you know, they're trying to tell the story of the Targaryen Targaryen king who used to be a Stark and is unable to deal with it. But honestly, I thought the snub was pretty unwarranted.
There is a funny, one of the funniest shit posts I saw on r/Game of Thrones was someone, the top frame was Rhaegal getting shot by, you know, one of those big spears. Mm-hmm. And then the bottom frame was the shot of Euron, like, aiming it, but they'd photoshopped him out and put Ghost behind it. And he just said, bitch, you know, like...
Yeah.
Essentially, oh, you're going to be you're going to be the new pet. Well,
a lot of
that.
Good it did him.
Yeah. Mark T, as John is no longer a black brother after his death, and all the others are dead following Dolorous Ed, that leaves Sam as the only known surviving black brother. Does that make him Lord Commander by default, or does he have to formally vote for himself as the only candidate?
Yeah, I think it does.
Actually, yeah. I think the next Lord Commander is going to be whatever wildling decides to squat in Castle Black and be put
Tormund
on a black...
Tormund said he was headed through there, so...
Put on a black cloak and be like, look at me, I'm King Crow. He'll just be Lord Commander, because right. Who's going to say otherwise?
Fair.
So whoever first takes over Castle Black and finds a discarded black cloak will be the new Lord Commander. All right, Rob C., any chance Qyburn tries to reanimate Rhaegal like he did with the Mountain?
Oh, fuck.
I mean, would that be a giant shark jumping... Like, people gave the Night King shit for being able to have, like, steel chains to drag a shallow...
Oh, he is at the bottom of the bay, isn't he?
But, yeah, that's in the ocean. I mean, it could be hundreds of
feet
deep.
Could be very, very deep.
Like, you gotta understand, before scuba technology, 50 feet deep was, like, damn near unreachable.
Mm-hmm. That's fair. I don't think they can.
Yeah.
I don't think they can.
Yeah. All right. Karma C.
I got it.
Yeah.
The mountain walks to Rhaegal
with a big chain,
with a big ass chain, and hauls
doesn't
him out
have to
himself
because he's dead already.
Yep.
All right.
They just strap the fucking heaviest armor they can to him.
Yeah.
There you go.
We need like a snappy
he's strong
name
enough
for that theory, like Clegane, like you know the Clegane Brothers tow truck service, or Gregor's Salvage and Reclamation Company.
Let's take contributions
that
from the audience.
What was the name of the mission?
If you have a good name for it, send it in.
Do you remember like when Howard Hughes like took a special purpose built ship and he said he was like drilling for oil or something? He was actually stealing a Russian submarine. This is a real story to happen.
I don't
on planet
know
Earth
about this. Wow.
We need to find whatever the code name that he was working with to see. We need to just that's the theory.
Okay.
Or we can workshop it. Karma C, who is this new Prince of Dorne? Will they be of any help in the battle for King's Landing? I mean, maybe, but I mean, he exists. That's literally all we know about him.
But I think it's conspicuous that they mention it.
Yeah.
You know, we have a theory that Yara might rally the forces of Dorne
right
and come save them in the last moment, or who knows?
It's just that there's two episodes left. Like, I don't know how you set that up, or it doesn't feel like a complete ass pull. Like, if Jon and Dany are getting their ass kicked outside the gates of King's Landing and these dumb fucks with sun spears roll up and it's like, oh, I mean, even Yara doing it, I guess. Yeah, I mean, there's ways they can make that pull off, but every second that lapses of screen time from here on, it makes that be less and less likely.
Yeah.
All right, two left. Mike R., while resigned to the fact that Double D's have washed their hands of the White Walkers, I'm curious about the wildlings and what they might find after returning home. With the Whites no longer a threat, there's no restrictions outside of adverse weather and how far north they could wander. If the Night King came from the wildlings' definition of the north, who's to say there's nothing or not someone or something up there? If the Night King was acting alone, raising his army as he headed southwards, could there not be others of his kind living in peace and isolation? I don't think so.
No, the story they've told is that he's the progenitor of all of them.
Yeah, he was the White Walker Prime.
Yeah.
So when
he dies, everyone should die.
Even if there was an offshoot of others that were just minding their own business, that'd be funny.
He only brought half his army.
Right. They're just sitting up there chilling, you know, watching White Walker television, and they just explode into ice cubes in their living rooms.
Right.
Also on the subject of wildlings, does Dany intend to have them bend the knee as subjects of the realm should she win the throne or leave the free folk to their own devices? I actually thought that was going to be a bone that Dany had to pick with John. Like, when they would say goodbye, she's like, oh, you just let my army of wildlings go? Like, I didn't give royal permission for that. Mm. And then they'd have a fight about the distinction between kneelers and non-kneelers, but...
Yeah.
No, they didn't do that.
They're not included in the Seven Kingdoms, right?
They're not.
So, maybe she won't want to have that hold over them?
There are many, many peoples on this planet that would say... That doesn't matter. Like,
there's, oh, I agree. Yeah,
there's been people pressed and conscripted for even more ludicrous defenses of stupider causes against their will. So,
but she's not trying to be the queen of Essos either, right? So, you know, she's focused on the Seven Kingdoms.
See, that's
right,
the thing.
Now
she should be. She should be. Like if Essos goes to shit because
if you want justice in Westeros, why don't you want it in Essos, right?
Right. Like, you brought it there yourself. Yeah. You set Dario on your throne, and then if he mismanages it, you got to go over there and fix that. Like, I don't think you can, but it's just two episodes left. Essos is
off the board.
Is a dream of spring at this point. JR, final one. All the complaints about the season, which for the most part are valid in my eyes, the character issues, logic issues, jetpacking, quick resolutions, forced situations, convenient scene endings. We all should have expected this, right? Once we became aware that the Double D's one would be done to move on to other projects, we should have expected these holes, these plots, theories, prophecies being thrown aside. We feared the rush in Season 7 and got it, and the same for Season 8 so far. Just wanted your thoughts on the concept that we should have expected issues in the show when the showrunners want to be done. Secondly, why do you think HBO accepted that the Double D's wanted to end the show and end it rapidly? HBO or any network will never have a phenomenon of a show like this again. If the D's wanted to move on, why not get someone else to take over? And I know some of the actors want to be done. Why not kill them off if they wanted to leave or replace the actors? I don't think the viewers were asking for a show to be rushed to an end or HBO themselves. It was just the showrunners. Do you think it's accurate that the Dan and David want this to be done with as quickly as possible? Because I don't...
It seems evident to me at this point.
But spent so much time and effort and money doing this final season.
Uh-huh.
Like, I don't... It doesn't seem fair to say they half-assed it or... I mean, maybe they rushed the storytelling.
I think so. I think they did shortened seasons. They rushed some of the storytelling, and I think it was in an effort to get to the end of this thing because, you know, they've been working on this for a decade now. Like, people lose interest in something like that.
Not only that, but again, like we've said this a million times, but this was a labor of love, adapting this book series that they loved, and then the creator himself couldn't be bothered to finish it. So, like... You know, it is. God, this could be the only ending in Game of Thrones we ever see, or Song of Ice and Fire. Like, and honestly, I think the people that think that that's more likely that George will finish than not, I think, are way delusional. Like, every year that comes is almost more certain that we'll never have a better conclusion than we're getting to the story than the one we're getting now.
Yeah, it's so. Let me say this first before I move on to my other point. But I think there's a difference to be. There's a difference between seeing something and being dissatisfied by something. Like, seeing something coming and expecting it doesn't mean that you're actually gonna like it, right? So even if we saw it coming, our expectation is that this is gonna be good up to the standard of Game of Thrones in past seasons, even if we understand that the creators are over it and they want to be done with it. Mm-hmm. I still think we have an expectation, and we should have that expectation as an audience, that this is going to be just as good as previous seasons. And I don't think it has quite. So
now HBO's end, like, these guys are under contract. Like, I don't know what it would look like. First of all, there's been a lot of fans have been saying, like, this show's gone to shit. I don't think it's gone to shit.
No.
But it's there has been, in my mind, a noticeable drop in the quality of the writing. But to say that, like, Season 7 was just, like I think a lot of people are acting like, in hindsight, Season 7's a colossal failure, and the HBO
should
have
there's, like, one episode that has a couple of scenes that are bad and a couple of missteps. Season 7 is good.
Yeah. But like, the fact that HBO would see, like, 100 million people worldwide watching, and, like, everyone's still in anticipation, and be like, you know what? going to take this Dan and Dave guy out to dinner and tell him their services will no longer be needed for these last six episodes. Like, that's... You need to be Bran plugged into the Weirwood network to... And the other thing is, there's still two fucking episodes left. What if... You know, and I'm not going to say this because I declared bankruptcy. I'm just seeing what happens. So, but what if they pay off Bran's warging? And what if they have something like really satisfying and emotionally resonant between John and Danny? And, you know, like they're like, if you'd ask a lot of people midway through season seven, whether that's going to be a good season or bad season, there'd been a lot of people like, I don't know. Mm-hmm. And we're at that point. There's still three episodes worth of television left and two episodes that we're going to get. So, I mean, again, I don't encourage people to, if you're disappointed, I think you should keep your expectations low, but I'm not willing to say, and even, God, I mean, I hate talking about this shit. This is why I sometimes when I'm a fan, I just wish I didn't have to podcast about it because, like, it's a lot easier wrestling this stuff privately. But, like, if season eight turns out to be a giant turd, how do people remember Game of Thrones? Because I feel like the narrative is, like, Game of Thrones was an amazing, awesome, groundbreaking work of genre work that fell apart at the end because the source material wasn't there. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't think anyone comes away from this looking like an asshole, except for maybe the Double D's, maybe George Martin. But, like, yeah. And honestly, yeah, like, bottom line is, like, I don't think anyone comes away from this looking worse other than Martin if he never finishes the book, or if he finishes them, they're the same or worse.
Yeah, I do think that...
But that's just me.
I really believe, and there's a precedent for this within fantasy literature, that these books will be finished. Maybe not by Martin.
He's dead set against somebody. That.
Yeah, but when he's dead, what say does he have?
That's true. I guess it'd be his heirs and, and assignees and all that.
And there's precedent for this. I mean, it happened with Robert Jordan in his Wheel of Time series. Like, you can bring in another writer. I think this will be very contentious amongst the fans.
Especially if it's against Martin's will. But, holy shit.
Yeah, but, like, what do you want? Yeah. Do you want your incomplete series of books and a could have been, or do you want somebody to maybe try and bring it home satisfactorily?
I think that if Martin, like, on his deathbed, spends a day or two with a well-regarded fantasy author and says, I want you to finish this, my son / daughter.
Gives his blessing, yeah.
Gives his blessing. Even then... Unless this is like even if it's in, even if it's satisfying, there's still going to be a lot of people like, boy, I'd really like to see what George would have done.
100%. Like, it's people, like, will exist.
Yeah. I don't know. It's going to be fascinating to track the fandom after this because, like, there will like, for damn sure, George is still writing books. He's got another one coming out this year, the second volume of the Targaryen shit. He's got there's several prequels that's in the work. One is greenlit and being in pre-production right now. And there's casting, and that looks pretty interesting and good. Like, it will be interesting to see what becomes of the fandom. And, like, you know, I think that's the real stakes here is, like, if everyone's, like, roundly disappointed by the way this, like, instantly enthusiasm for all these projects, I think, is at least temporarily set back. But I don't know.
We'll see.
There's other franchises. It's, you know what? If you declared bankruptcy, I got a little thing that I like to set a little long-term investment called The Expanse.
Hell yes.
It's Game of Thrones in space.
These guys are writing a book a year.
They're writing a book a
year.
And
they're stellar.
There's two guys, so you got some redundancy in there if something goes wrong with one of their work ethic or brain or body.
And we're covering it in a podcast called Belta Loda. Look it up.
The adaptation is a lot of fun. You know, but then again, we're approximately like in Red Wedding territory for The Expanse.
Yeah.
We're so, like, it's
deep in the heart of the best part of it.
They still got seasons where they could shit the bed and rush an adaptation. But, you know, if you're looking for something to fill that deeply plotted, politically relevant and interesting, deep cast a mile long, but still some fantasy weird shit thrown in there, too, then you can head your bets with The Expanse right now. Everybody else, I guess, we're, you know. That's what I'd do if I declare bankruptcy. Start reinvesting.
For sure. Elsewhere.
So, all right. Game of Thrones at baldmove.com is where you want to send all the hate mail and feedback and the love and all the stuff that we get each week. You can also get on our forums, talk it over with your fellow fans at forums.baldmove.com. We will be back this Sunday. Well, no, I'm sorry. I'm way ahead of myself. It's beginning of the week still. We'll be back Friday with the spoiler edition where we'll delve a little bit deeper into the books and what might happen or maybe our disappointments with it or just the world of Ice and Fire is amazing, a place to explore just in and of itself if you're a lore hound like myself. That comes out Friday, and then we do it all over again on Sunday with the instant take right after the 9 p.m. showing of Game of Thrones and instant talk for our club members. Don't forget, this is the last opportunity you can lock in those 25% off on annual memberships, both new and renewing. The sale ends after today, this Tuesday.
No, and tomorrow? Is it the 7th already?
Is it?
Fuck me, is it the
7th? It's the
7th. Oh, yeah, you better get on that.
Unless Jim forgets to shut it off in the store tonight, the deal will be ending tonight. So to lock it in if you're listening to this on a Tuesday or maybe wee hours of the morning on Wednesday. And we'll see you back for all this stuff. this Friday, I can't ever end the podcast.
It's every
correctly.
Day. It's every day on Game of Thrones.
Also Wednesday, there's going to be a Dragonheart. We got our super serious film fest rolling on. Dragonheart's coming out.
Yeah, but you heard all this. You heard all this before.
I'm just reminding you. Just reminding you for the people who stayed at the bitter end. All right. Until the next time, I'm Aaron.
And I'm Jim.
See ya.